you know, there's April Fool's Day, but we have a full agenda, and we have all to work out. And before we begin, I'd like to introduce the President and CEO of the Hynix, Mr. Dongwon Pak, good friend of mine. I'd like to have him give us just a beginning small greetings.
Thank you. And we really appreciate you choosing this company for your meeting. Today is very special for us. Not only we have an opportunity to have honorable guests with us, but we have another opportunity to show what we are doing so far to the presentation. I'd like to introduce two gentlemen to show you the presentation. Please welcome Sid, Don, and Greg Sladen. Thank you.
Thank you. And I just want to say that the, about the 5 years ago, the Hynix at the time here in May donated $100,000 to have a Korean War Memorial, which was erected in the Wilsonville, Oregon. And that has been instrumental to have a Korean War Memorial after 50 years later that the Korean War ended, for which I'm deeply grateful as a Korean American myself. Okay, let's begin by telling the presentation from the Hynix and Steve and Greg.
Good afternoon, gentlemen and committee. I'd like to, my name is Steve Dorn. I'm the Human Resources Manager here at Hynix. I'm going to present some information on the company history.
Hold on one second. What's the sound? Where the sound coming from?
The bow voice.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just members of the committee staff. I would say the legislature has purchased what we have been told is excellent equipment that has an automatic feedback elimination system. As you know, the characteristics of the room change from the time we set this up. We are relatively confident that this problem will be taken care of. All right. And after this presentation, we will have a time to introduction of each member and plus all the distinguished guests. So let's go ahead with the project and all the introduction will be followed.
Okay, so I'd like to give you a company overview. This is our facility here in Eugene. Right now we're in the cafeteria, which is right there. When you went on the tour, you went through the administration building, went across that little sky bridge, and then you walked about three-fourths of the way down the fabrication building. And that's the main part of our site. It also includes a utility building where all the water and air conditioning and that kind of thing goes on, as well as the gas plant down on that end of the facility. Hynix Semiconductor Worldwide Manufacturing is located in four locations at this time, starting with Incheon, South Korea. That is where Hyundai Electronics originally started in 1993. Also in Cheongju, South Korea, we have wafer fab facilities there. Then in Eugene, where we have our 8-inch wafer fab here. And then finally, Wuxi, China, is where we will be expanding this to give us updates and worldwide presence. What we make is memory, so we that people use in their everyday life. You can see some of the products, computers, consumer electronics, and cameras and items of that nature. So just about everything people are touching these days are using contains memory from finance. Our history here in Eugene, we decided to build here in 1995. We had groundbreaking in February of 1996. The construction took a couple of years. We started our first product in 1998 in January. And then we had further ramp up in May of 1998 to what at that time was considered our maximum capacity, which was 30,000 wafers a month. Then, as everyone, I think people are aware, in 2001, we had a major retooling. At that time, we did have a temporary layoff of employees. And after that was completed, we offered those employees to adopt that, and a huge portion would come back and still continue to work here today. At that time, we resumed operation with our group ship, which was very good technology for us and really helped the company work out of its financial difficulties. And we continue to upgrade. We're working on even better, faster ships today. Why a fab in the U.S., the necessity of having something here. First, talked earlier about global position. We now have a global presence. Having something here in the U.S. is very important. Also, contingency planning. You don't want to have all your factories in one spot. A lot of times, semiconductor companies started moving out of California because they were worried about earthquakes shutting down all their production. So the same thing, by spreading out, we can survive either some sort of natural disaster or some sort of bug like that. Next, close to strategic customers. You'll see our customers here, HP, IBM, Sun, Dell, Apple, Gameway. Those companies are all headquartered here in the U.S., and it's very important to be there. That's a trade issue. I'm sure you've all heard a lot about that in the U.S., but for us, this factory is able to produce the products that would be exempt from those tariffs. Why Eugene? We started here. First thing we looked at is education. University of Oregon's here, Lincoln Community College is here. They've partnered with us throughout our entire time and been very helpful to us. Also, Oregon State University has also been very helpful. High quality workforce. We were able to partner with the Oregon Employment Department, and they helped us hire the manufacturing force that we needed. And between they and OCC, we were able to train a world-class manufacturing force. Quality of life. Thought that would attract good people to Hynix, and the community is very attractive to live in. Good place to raise a family, a lot of activity here. Reasonable cost of living, maybe not the lowest in the country, but it's still more reasonable than a lot of the big areas in the country. Tax exemption programs certainly pay a part in that. Having incentives to help a partnership with the community, and I think we work in good partnership with the education institutions here and other local entities to build a world-class manufacturing facility. And finally, logistics, having other semiconductor companies in Oregon, they need the infrastructure to support a facility like this. They typically wouldn't build something like this in Nevada because there are no other fabs. And it would be very hard to get your parts and your supplies and things that you need. So, infrastructure really plays a part. Also, our important network is very important to us from a transportation standpoint. Just briefly here in Hynix, we have our market share. We're number two in the world. Back when we were retooling, we were not doing so well, but the company has had a steady increase in the business. Late last year, we were able to overtake the number three position in the world, and now we're the number two. This is chronology of our technology. When we started, we where we would basically a 0.2 foot background, which is was very small, but as this chart is going to go down in size, so the bar going down is actually a good thing. It's indicating that the product is getting smaller, it's doing more. So you can see our development here. We started with 64 meg synchronous VM. This is about where we did the retooling. This blue line is our fab in Korea, and this line is us. We had a small departure there as we did the retooling, but now we run parallel and replace that fab. This fab runs our highest technology. And then we graduated in the 256 megabyte DDR, which stands for double data rate memory, which is faster memory, and that's what everyone wants in their products. Then we've gone from 256 to 512. Finally coming down here to the 512 and the 1 gigabyte, which is considered nanotechnology. As we've gone along here, we had an initial investment of $1.26 million. And we continue to invest year after year in new equipment that helps us make these more advanced chips. So you can see about $100,000 in last year, and this year in 2005, we'll continue to do the same thing. Briefly, some of the names and faces of people here at Hynix that live and work in our community here. We have a University of Oregon process engineer. She graduated from the material science program there. We get a lot of employees from that program, and it's semiconductor specific. This is Amy. She worked with us from the very beginning as a manufacturing technician, graduated to a supervisor, and is now a section manager in the manufacturing department. Kevin Jackson, he's an OIT graduate. So we have people coming from down around Final Falls, good program there. A couple of people here from the local area that are in the manufacturing area, that's Rachel. She's born, raised, and graduated from Pleasantville High School. And our family here is from Junction City. So we have a good cross-section of employees. Our employment status started in June 2002. This was after our retooling and as we started to ramp up. At that time, around 800 employees total. But as you can see, we've steadily gained in employee employment over the years as we went on retooling, increased the capacity of the factory, and tended to grow our number of employees. You can see here in 2005, we plan to add about another 100 employees during this year. Okay, we'd like to point out here just a family wage that we do offer. Our average annual compensation, including the cost of benefits, is about $70,000 per employee. Annual payroll of $53 million. Average pay without the benefits is $42,500. Non-exempt employee can make about $16 an hour. Exempt employees about $79 a year. Entry-level base pay, basically all that requires is a high school education or a GED, and start out at $10.50 an hour. The one thing I wanted to point out on this slide, there's a lot here you can look at it later, but the cost of family benefits to one of our employees. The company pays $900 a month in insurance costs. The employee shares a very small part of that, only $37. That leaves our employee with money to spend on other things that they would like to buy instead of spending on health care. And just some of the additional benefits, we have 401k's, we have plans for retirement, we have education reimbursement, which includes college tuition, employee assistance program, along with short-term disability insurance, and employee bonus programs. So far this year, we've paid out about $1.7 million. Our spending within Oregon, overall, with taxes and contributions, contracts, employees, supplies, and salary expenses, about $117 million. Our contributions to the community, we take this very seriously over the last internship program where employees get on-the-job experience, 825, and others, which includes things like United Way matching funds and things of that nature. And just briefly, I'm not going to go into detail on this, but there is a study out by the University of some students at the University of Oregon regarding the economic benefit of hikes to the community. And if you'd like more information on that, it's very easy to look up on Google. And we do show that basically for every dollar spent, there's about $5 coming back to the community. Okay. So that's it for me. And I'd like to pass it on to Brad for the environmental portion.
Thank you, Stu. Committee members, I'd like to welcome you to HYNEX Eugene. Well, thank you for your time this afternoon. As you are probably aware, when Hyundai first began operations here in Eugene, there were many members of the community that were concerned about the potential impact that a facility of this size and nature might have on this environment here in West Eugene. The Korean culture is one of community. Hyundai was committed, and HYNEX remains committed, to being a good corporate citizen. In order to address the community's concerns, Hyundai implemented a strong environmental program early on. The program has continued to grow and mature here at HYNEX. I would like to briefly review some of the aspects of that program with you. Hyundai operates an environmental management system that is certified to the ISO 14001 standard. The standard requires the effective implementation of many elements, including documented procedures, documentation control, effective communication and training programs, and continuous improvement, to name a few. The program undergoes a rigorous 3-day audit annually by Underwriters Laboratory, and also we do over 30 internal audits every year. And the purpose of all of these audits is to verify the sustainability, suitability, and effectiveness of the environmental program. HYNEX's environmental policy can be summed up by the acronym of CLEAN, for continuous improvement, living by all laws and regulations, ensuring all views of interested parties are heard, and adopting permanent solutions to prevent pollution, never settling for mere compliance. The heart of the environment of the environmental management system are our employers. Each employee is an important member of the system, working to minimize the amount of waste created during the execution of their job, maximizing the amount of recycling, and contributing ideas and recommendations on how to improve processes through targeting. The focus and contribution of the over 1,000 employees and on-site vendors combined to provide significant environmental value. HYNEX's environmental team is active in the community, serving on the Lane Regional Air Pollution Authority Citizens Advisory Committee, the McKenzie Watershed Council, the Eugene Toxic Right to Know Board. Additionally, HSMA makes available its natural areas to the Rachel Carson School for on-site environmental study, as well as classwork, and we partner with the Riverfront School to complete on-site wetland and stormwater area restoration and maintenance. HYNEX has also been involved in the Oregon State University NECOP intern program for the past several years, providing engineering mentors and meaningful hands-on industry experience for the program's interns. As we move forward, HSMA would like to increase our involvement in the community by providing a high school level internship program during the summers, an environmental health and safety annual report to be distributed locally, as well as increasing our involvement in the West Eugene wetlands. The total HYNEX site is approximately 220 acres. Of that, 150 acres is wetlands, 10 acres are designated as uplands, and 10 acres are set aside for the stormwater treatment pumps. HYNEX attempts to follow best management practices in the management of the natural areas, including invasive species control, stormwater and erosion control, groundwater monitoring, and habitat enhancement. We also maintain a strong relationship with our neighbors, including the Nature Conservancy. In the near future, we will begin a joint project with the Nature Conservancy and the Oregon Fish and Wildlife to begin the reintroduction of endangered and threatened plant species into a natural area. Hyannis' air, wastewater, stormwater, and hazardous waste operations are regulated by state and local agencies. Hyannis is continually looking for ways to recycle, reuse, and reduce our waste streams. We've reduced our water usage and wastewater discharge by over 25% since beginning operations, while significantly increasing volumes. Additionally, and significantly, the vast majority, over 98%, of all spent manufacturing materials on site are reused, recycled, or used for energy recovery. Less than 2% would go to landfill. Last year, Hynek was recognized for our care and maintenance of our on-site wetlands by the West Eugene Wetland Partnership and for our environmental values by the City of Eugene Chamber of Commerce. Hynek believes that with a true spirit of cooperation between business and community, that businesses can strongly support and contribute to the betterment of the local community. That strong partnerships between community and businesses benefit all members of the community, and that clearly defined laws and regulations help to foster that partnership. Thank you again for your time this afternoon. Steve and I are available for any questions now or after.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Any questions from the panel? None, I got two questions. And could you give us the short term and the long term the vision, the plan in the future of the time?
So I think I mentioned in the presentation that we see about $100 million a year spending for upgrades. So for the next 3 to 5 years, I think we can see that continuing as we start to make faster and faster, smaller and smaller products, that we will continue to invest in that. I think beyond 5 years is very difficult to tell because the industry changes so much and so quickly, and it's really hard to have that crystal ball.
The question I have is that workforce is a critical issue, not only here but the statewide. And where do you get your workforce locally, nationally, worldwide? And try to have some ideas you have.
So our workforce, Lane County is a huge part of our workforce. We work with the Oregon Employment Department to get people that are all in here to work in the manufacturing area and all of our office and administrative areas. So most of those people are just from right here in the area. We train them, put together all the programs so they learn what they're doing and are able to be productive. Professional and technical, I would say 95% of that comes from Oregon School of Higher Education. Typically, national hasn't worked out real well because a lot of people come and they see they don't like the rain. And so, going. So it's best to focus on people that are interested in the area, like the area, and we've been very successful with that.
We need to mention to them this week we need to have much rain. Last year, one of the best winter in the nation.
Yeah.
Most of the rain is the south.
Yeah.
And what's the percentage of the local hiring of the total workforce you have? Because local hiring is very
important.
Allow us to use this facility. and we are deeply grateful for your generosity, and including their nice sandwich provided for us. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
My name is Astoria Kim. I'm strategy planning.
Thank you.
I am the director, CEO and president of this company. Thank you for coming.
Okay, at this time, I want to thank you. Oh, one more. I'm sorry.
Yes, and I'm Jill Gay, formerly Jill Watkins, director of Quality Assurance.
Thank you. I just want to acknowledge at this time the dear Roberts that we are gracious enough to give us a tour, mm-hmm. and we appreciate that. Now, with that, we can begin. Thank you.
Thank you. you, Representative Lim. I think before I make my comments, I'd like to be sure that the folks that are here with me, that are city council candidates, and the Spence folks.
I'm George Foley, city council president, and I represent the Northeast Parliamentary.
Good afternoon. My name is Chris Pryor. I am the city council representing Ward 8, the ward in which this plant is located. Welcome.
Thank you.
I'm Betty Taylor. I'm representing Ward 2, which is Southeast Virginia.
Thank you.
Representative Lim and mayors and members of the Trade and Economic Development Committee, welcome to the meeting. We're so glad to have you here. And I especially welcome my friend and former legislative colleague, Representative Lim, to our city. I had a chance to meet with him for a few minutes earlier today, and also enjoy very much having former city councilor Bobby Nitti here with us today. I hope we will have many opportunities to work together. We also appreciate Primex for hosting this committee visit. As you no doubt have heard, Primex is one of our largest employers with an annual payroll exceeding $50 million and paying about 6% of the total taxes collected in this community. Primex has worked to meet community goals for environmentally sensitive development, working to reach Nature Conservancy standards and to meet rigorous standards for industrial safety. The provision of jobs, a safe work environment, as well as natural resource protection are all important to our community. Partnerships are important to successful and responsible economic development. Partnerships between the city, county, the state, and between the public and private sectors are all important. They need to be based on a nexus of sound investment and economic, social, and environmental benefits to the community. Cities need tools for economic development, a way to target and grow the kind of development that is desired. I'm going to make some brief comments about our local economy, some of the opportunity we see on the horizon, and highlight the city's interest in some tools made available through our partnership with you in the state. Eugene experienced a weakening of its manufacturing base as it moved away from dependence on wood products industry during the 90s. The effect on Eugene was not as serious as some other communities because we are fortunate enough to be the home of the University of Oregon and have the presence of several state, county, local government as part of our economic base. Secondly, we have a good number of small to medium-sized manufacturers that have stayed in the community because they value the quality of life and a highly educated workforce. This includes Hynix in Beecherton, PNCS Scanning, and Electrical Geodesics. We still have challenges with too few jobs that pay adequate wages to support our families. This can be especially seen in the increase in retail and service industry jobs. Housing costs are rising much faster than wages, placing an additional burden on our families. We have lost some major employers such as Sony, Larsen, and Dynamics. Overall, though, there is great energy in this community. Despite some of the very real state and national economic challenges, we in Eugene believe we can continue to move in an optimistic and socially responsive direction. There is interest all across our community in creating new successful niches for sustainable business development. You can see it in new interest in biodiesel fuel, natural foods, biotech, and much, much more. We are ready to surge forward to a new level of economic leadership in this state. We are promoting Eugene as the greatest city for arts and the outdoors, capitalizing on our high quality of life that draws people here and keeps them here. Our downtown is being promoted as our cultural epicenter. A local research institute will be moving its 300 employees into a new $20 million downtown office building. We have constructed over 284 new units of housing downtown with 128 more planned, much of it to meet affordable mixed housing needs. We have a $70 million plus federal courthouse underway, and I might add, one of the best architectural examples in the country right now. And an $85 million hospital building is likely, we hope very likely. These are powerful catalysts for further redevelopment downtown. The city has interest, though, in three economic development tools, and in our partnership with the state in having those tools available to our community. Enterprise zones, multi-unit property tax exemption, and vertical housing exemption. Eugene is currently planning to apply later this month for one of the state's designated enterprise zone can be an effective tool for attracting new investments to our industrial area to generate jobs for the community and that need areas that need redevelopment. We expect there to be competition for this year's enterprise zone application round, but we feel this is an opportunity for Eugene for new high-quality investments, both in new enterprise and our strong base of existing companies. The multiple unit tax exemption is another tool of interest to us, which provides for a 10-year tax exemption for housing in the core area and along transit corridors. The city must adopt the program, establish a boundary, and approve each individual exemption. The land continues to be taxed. The vertical housing zone program is similar, but it provides an incentive for constructing mixed-use buildings by providing an exemption for the housing portion of the building. The state manages the program. Both of these housing programs are essential to building our downtown, maintaining compact urban growth, meeting our transportation goals, and of course, commercial reinvestment and job creation. These are the only tools available to us to encourage downtown housing, and it is expensive to build downtown. I ask for your support for these programs. And I want to point out that accessible housing helps us deal with our homeless and poverty issues as well. Thank you so much for coming to our city and for the effort the legislature is making to really reach out across Oregon to hear from our communities about our plans, successes, challenges, and specific needs. We very much appreciate your time. Welcome to Eugene.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions? Okay, Representative Gallum.
Thank you very much. You mentioned two programs that we looked at. Actually, three in the past few months. When you talk about attracting business, the heat zones, are they helpful?
Well, I believe our experience in Eugene has been that we were able to help some large business come in, and we're also able to help some of our existing businesses to grow. We think we have been, I think, one of the more successful users of the enterprise zone. We have experienced some challenges with some folks in the community really appreciating enterprise zones and some not being real supporters, and that would be usual for us as we all strive to do the right thing. So, yes, I think enterprise zone is not the magic bullet. It's a tool. It can be used to do good things, and it can be used for not such a thing. So, in our case, we want to target the enterprise zone and use it for the kind of development we'd like in our community.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. You talked about targeting. Well, the enterprise zone is presently targeted for economically depressed areas. If it were new for you, would you continue to target the area?
The area that we have targeted our zone for is an industrial area that really needs a lot of redevelopment. So I think it's right in line with what the plan is for enterprise zone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mayor. Going farther with what Representative Dowling was referring to, how about the competition aspect? Do you think there's a healthy component to competing for a limited number of enterprise zones? Or do you think that an area that can be anywhere else, if somebody could qualify from an economic distress standpoint, ought to be able to apply in a different enterprise zone and not have to compete with some other part of the state?
I think I've spent a lot of time thinking about that. I would say you know, I'm 3 months into this job. you want to do that?
I can give you, I can try and give you an example.
And will you please state your name?
Yes, I'm George Ford, the City Council.
Thank you.
Recently, Oregon Research Institute has started to do the process to purchase the old city building and move their operations to the downtown core. What we as a city are trying to do is have people live and work in the downtown area. By using the vertical housing, we're able to bring in more people to actually live within the downtown core and work within the walkway. One development underway by our local developer, multi-story housing, condominium type of housing can actually be purchased instead of just another apartment complex or a rental complex. So that's the type of procedure that we're doing to try and target the vertical housing and how it's going to help our downtown and move on lots.
I can add to that. I think one of the things we want to do is not just have low-cost housing, but we want to have mixed housing. And this is one tool for us to bring in housing of different levels that will eventually be good taxpaying members of our community.
Springfield Metro Partnership. I'm currently representative on the current LADE Metro Partnership. I've been on recruiting trips to various locations. I've talked to businesses about what they are looking for when they're trying to find a place to relocate or to locate to, and the businesses when they're trying to expand. And to summarize it all into a simple concept, it would probably be the notion that the best economic development strategy is one that balances the quality of life within a community with its ability to provide a quality of livelihood. And the best example of that, which I would use, is this plant right here. When at that time Hyundai first came to town and built the facility, I was on the school board, the Eugene 4J School District. And after they had built their plant and hired their employees, we received, unsolicited, a letter from Hyundai thanking us for providing them with one of the best workforces they had ever encountered anywhere in the world. And that was a tribute to the education system that provided those workers and provided that resource, but it was also a very significant representation of the balance I'm talking about. If you don't invest in the quality of life in a community, then it doesn't really help the quality of livelihood. And so while we encourage the use of incentives such as an enterprise zone, because I see that also as representing that important balance, they come here for the quality of life, but they also come here because there's an economic engine that encourages them to run, and that's what Enterprise Zone does. They also come here for the schools, and they come here for the parks, and they come here for the recreation and the clean water. They really valued the clean water that was available in this area. They worked very hard to keep the water clean in this area. As you saw in the presentation up there, they've invested millions of dollars in this area. So I'll just leave by saying the enterprise zone is a good idea. It's not the only tool, but it's a very important tool to maintain the balance. And to Representative Broom's question about how many places in Oregon should be able to have enterprise zones, I say anybody that needs one should be able to have one. I don't want to have to compete with Ashland. Say hi to Gino for me. Because they probably need one as well. We need one. It's an important tool. It's an effective tool, but it's not the only tool. And as you deliberate on these important issues, remember that what has worked for us right here in Lane County and in Eugene has been maintaining a good and effective balance between our quality of life and our quality of livelihood. I think that's what really works for us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Councilor Pryor. And nice to see you. Thank you, Melissa. Thank you.
Actually, I don't think they want me to speak.
I just you want you to speak.
So I'll just say thank you for coming here and chairman Lynn. I mean, we were just talking to your committee, a committee that you served on yesterday.
Yes.
In Salem. It's nice to see you here. Also nice to see Bobby back here. I got a longer term as acting president of the council because Bobby retired early. He was president before me. I have different views about the enterprise zone, which I won't talk about right now. I do love Ashland. I agree that you are, can compete with us for the best city for the arts part certainly. And what I would like to see is an enterprise incentive that is not geographical, that could be limited to sustainable businesses, and it could be focused on small local businesses wherever they are in the community. And it is not the prevailing point of view of the current city council. Thank you. And I want to apologize also, I have to run out of it. Otherwise, I'd love to stay in much longer.
Thank you for coming and presenting. Any questions? Representative Bellum?
Yes, my question is directed to you, Mr. Pryor. The focus of the enterprise zone is to bring employment to economically distressed areas, to measure unemployment, and sources in poverty levels. So apparently this area qualifies for that. I think I agree with you. Trying to sort out here as we monitor this project. Should we continue?
up our area. Our community is made up of a diversity of economic and social strata. And that the lower strata, the strata in which enterprise zone will be targeted, actually benefits from that enterprise zone. Not only do we benefit from having beginning to provide educational opportunities, beginning to provide a good workforce, but it actually does help the disadvantaged and the economically less advantageous areas. Not only for businesses wanting to relocate here, but also for people that want to start their businesses and grow their businesses right here. So it has the benefit on both sides.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Question. Our council understands the courage limitations of what you can do, kind of qualifications that you can put around enterprise zones. But we have interest in kind of an express in our city council of locally trying to add some community standards about wages, benefits, those kinds of things, and that's yet on our table for future discussion. But we really have a strong interest not only in targeting the area where we think we can help our local businesses grow and our industrial area, but also targeting it with some community standards and hope that will encourage business that will actually raise the bar, which I think is the intention that you're spoken about as well.
Having lived in Brownsville, I can't for the life of me see why anybody would want to live between here and Brownsville.
I think we need to move on, and we're done not yet. Well, I guess we can be. And I just want to thank you, each one of you, especially Mayor, my good friend, and coming to testify on this issue. As a matter of fact, in our committee, the House Trade and Economic Committee, we are really looking to the matter of e-commerce zone, and which we already passed out. And where is that?
In the revenue committee.
That's in the revenue committee now. And also the vertical housing issue, we also discussed it earlier. That one now still in a discussion. That's also in the revenue committee. So we want to know our committee is working hard to improve the economy of our state. And also today we are going to discuss the issue on enterprise zone, House Bill 3143. And so I believe these three bills are very important for the future of the economy and jobs, and we will continue working with you on this issue. We need your help when we have a lively discussion and pass out possibly in the revenue committee or in the Senate. With that, and thanks and God bless you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
As we move into the next panel of hearing, I just want to say that the Eugene area is a vibrant city, especially in terms of three E's. One E is education, this is a city of education, and another E is economy, another E is, as we all know, is environment. As a matter of fact, I belong to all of those committees in the House. And if any company can survive, like Hynix in Eugene, the company can survive any place in the world. I believe what I said, I truly mean it. And thank you very much for working hard. Okay, at this time, I'd like to have City of Springfield, the Mayor, the Honorable Sidney Lightman. Welcome.
Thank you. We want to be too formal, so say words for 12 to so. Anyway, Chairman, members of the committee, pleased to be here. And I again want to say thank you to Finance for hosting us. Very, very testimony won't be too long, because there's only one of me. And but before I, in fact, some of the enterprise zone questions, I would love to entertain, because in particular, Springfield has been very aggressive with the enterprise program over the years, and I think I can comment on that. Well, our staff member here, John Tanny Lomas, isn't here yet today, but John is actually really one of the foremost experts in enterprise zones throughout the state, and we've been able to use that, I think, to our advantage quite well. But I'm more happy to entertain questions at the end. But just to give you quickly on presentation of where Springfield is today, you might well tell Gina hello. And I talked to him about 3 weeks ago. So he says that there's plenty of snow in Mount Ashland. So Matt, I guess that's good news. First of all, let me talk about some of the accomplishments and opportunities that are happening in Springfield currently. In 2001, there was a proposal of PeaceHealth, regional medical center, moving into Springfield. And I guess the good news is we finally passed the final master plan 6-0 on that vote, and so it may actually happen after all. It's been an appeal process for the last 3 years, and quite honestly, I think many things have been learned on the state planning because of this particular proposal throughout the state. And so it's very interesting that Springfield all of a sudden become a model on some of the issues of state land and particular transportation issues. And, but I think we've learned a lot throughout that process. The idea here is a $350 million regional healthcare facility, but again, this is a 180-acre master plan. The hospital site itself is roughly about 80 to 90 acres, so you're going to have another 100 acres to be planned out, which will include opportunities for housing as well as commercial aspects. We look at this more than just the jump from one area, from a hospital from one town to the next. Really, because the hospital itself is healthcare, and that's their main focus, healthcare. The other part of this really is going to be economic development, and it's going to be substantial investment into the community. In fact, some of the rough estimates currently are, by the time this is built out, this will be somewhere between $1 and $2 billion worth of investment into the area. This will be new small business expansion, new small business creation, as well as housing. And something that really we haven't seen in our community in years. And it's also a transformation, I think, overall of where Springfield is today and where it was. Springfield, of course, was such a wood products community and reliant on wood products for years. And even though that's a very strong part of our heritage that we appreciate, and still think it's a very important part, we're now moving into a whole new area of biomedical research and innovations. Because along with the hospital, we have Oregon Medical Lab moving into the old Sony building. And we're pleased with that because the Sony building actually remained vacant for just a little less than a year and a half. When you look around the state, you see 350,000 square foot tech buildings. A lot of them still remain vacant. So the fact that there's a user coming in with 500 employees now with the opportunity to expand beyond that, I think says good news, not just for Springfield, but for the entire metropolitan area. Symantec built in this. This is, by the way, an E-Zone piece as well, but Symantec built a new $36 million facility there a few years back in 2000. They went from the planning of a raw site to completion in just under a year, and so it was done quickly. Today, Symantec employs 850. They're currently looking to hire another 100, so they're actually coming close to reaching capacity of 1,100 employees, which is what the building will entail. What's interesting about Symantec today is that originally it was a call center, mostly for providing support to its individual corporate customers, but today that is really most of the operation there is actually software development with the Norton antivirus, along with a lot of the backroom areas of accounting and some of the financial networks as well. So, again, it's gone from a whole new area of what it was originally set to be. Royal Caribbean Cruise Lines is constructing a $60 million LEED certified customer service facility. In other words, very, very environmentally friendly, providing up to 1,000 jobs in the next 4 years. And one of the things they are doing as far as protecting the environment is using to provide backup
diesel electrical generation to the facility, but this is the biodiesel fuel that is from ordinary edible vegetable oil. So this is actually a very environmentally friendly operation of the building. One of the things that Spring Color Paint has been very good at is using partnerships. As most cities around the state, but I think particular cities, that we don't have many employees. We don't have a, what you call a real strong budget. We're struggling, as so many other cities around the state. But we truly rely on partnering with different communities here locally, as well as state and federal partners that we like to call a United Front approach. And that's been very, very successful for us over the years. One of the things that we were involved in from the get-go is providing a regional effort in Southwest Oregon to provide a substantial fiber optic ring for advanced data communications. This ring is hubs in Springfield, goes up Oak Ridge over Highway 58, and actually the ring then hooks into other areas, which covers not only the state, but all the way down to Southern California. Some of the strengths of Springfield in particular are, I think, are what we call Team Springfield, one of the few cities, if not the only city, that actually works with all of our jurisdictions. And that is the city, the utility board, the school district, and the park board actually meet twice a year. Our CEOs meet once a month, and the chairs meet once every other month. And what we try to do is to try to bring in common areas. What are some things that we can leverage? We all know we don't have the dollars to leverage, but how can we leverage things together? And it's been very, very successful. We've been doing this now for several years and don't see any plan on stopping now. So we are also the state's first drinking water overlay protection zone. We have that in place. That was at the request of the Springfield Utility Board, and that is to avoid new and existing development. It doesn't contaminate the local community's vital water resources. Springfield's drinking water is all underground, and so it's very, very important. My former business I was involved in many years ago, I owned a small chain of dry cleaners, and boy, I can try to truly understand how important protecting drinking water, especially groundwater, is. Our campus industrial zoning, we've revised this to be more of a performance-based for clean technology, knowledge-based industries. We went through an excellent exercise of updating this. What we need, want to make sure is our zoning is flexible and not just be used for just one type of industry. Industries change. The problem with government at times is that the government doesn't always change with where the market's going. And it's interesting when you look at a certain market, and especially where campus industrial zoning was used greatly with Sony, to think about where our market and industries have changed just over the last 8 or 9 years. And one of the things we had to do is update that and be much more flexible. And again, this allowed Oregon Medical Labs to come into zoning. Otherwise, this would not have been a use that would have been permitted without updating this zoning. We have high standards in our city, and we're proud of those standards. We are flexible, we're proactive, we try to work with all businesses, no matter the size. Yet we do let them know we expect a few things from them. Work with us to achieve higher development standards, contribute to a better community, and be leaders for the community. I think that's something that we expect. We expect good corporate citizens, really no matter what the size is. Here are some of the weaknesses. And this is where we really truly do qualify for enterprise zones today. Springfield's per capita income is the lowest of any of the larger cities in the state. It continues that way. And part of that is that we still quite haven't recovered from the recessions of the 70s and 80s, the wood products industry. That's how much Springfield was reliant on that industry during those times. We changed our economy very rapidly, but results haven't quite reached all of our citizens. And that's just a fact. We're certainly part of a larger metro area. The Eugene residents work in Springfield. Springfield works in Eugene and in other areas around the metropolitan area. Jobs creating Eugene or Springfield or Eugene are important to all metro residents. But again, just because jobs are created in one area does not necessarily mean that because the company is there, all the citizens from that city are going to be working there. Still, when you look at what's going to happen in Royal Caribbean, most likely, once they reach that 1,000 employment, about 500 or so will be Eugene residents. The other 500 will be residents from the greater area. with all that's underway, we don't need additional rules and obligations as subvert or undermine our local efforts that are so difficult already. And we continue to watch what goes on as far as actions that may harm home rule opportunities within communities. All of our local economic development efforts should not be undercut, frustrated, or delayed by momentary hiccups in developing or funding our transportation system. I guess you could say that's frustration now about some of the work that's been going on in Springfield, and at times our partnerships, if you want to call that, with the Oregon Department of Transportation. I'm sure you hear that quite often. So, but we still continue to try to keep them on the road and continue to work with them and do the best, I think, that all groups can. We need a consistent state support of needed transportation projects to allow successful local economic development efforts to proceed. Our success spills over to the rest of the state of Oregon. We recently passed an urban renewal district for Glenwood. Glenwood is right between Eugene and Springfield. It's an unincorporated area that is part of Lane County currently, but we had a planning jurisdiction. So we were able to pass an urban renewal district for this area. Urban renewal could help with relocation expansion plans of Williams Bakery to Glenwood, which is in the process of happening now. This in turn provides a needed site for building a replacement of Matt Court for the University of Oregon basketball program. Urban renewal could provide help to the first new commercial development in Glenwood, which is called Bring Recycling. And Bring is a new planned improvement center, partly a theme park, if you believe it or not, for 15,000 children and adults annually to learn about waste reduction, reuse, and recycling. Who would ever know think that waste reduction could be put in as a theme park? But urban renewal is one way for local organizations to focus revenues for a period of time and take corrective actions to long-standing infrastructure problems. So, with that, we're happy to entertain questions. Thank you very much again for the opportunity to testify.
Questions?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have asked the same question. Do you feel that with Springfield Enterprise Zone, that it has given you an opportunity to address the economic problems that you have? Has targeting Springfield been part of the reason you've been able to track on?
I think that's been part of it, but it's not the whole issue. Our city, the entire city is covered. Along with Glenwood is also an enterprise zone. And it kind of depends on what companies you're looking at. And first of all, we have a close working relationship with the Lane Metro Partnership and OECD. And I think is when we look at targeting different companies, understanding we have an enterprise zone, is that an advantage? Absolutely. We have 3 years of tax, property tax abatement, along with possibility of 2 years, depending on if you meet the requirements. But enterprise zones, of course, are formulas. They have to meet certain standards in order to qualify. So literally, we'll get applications of maybe 60 a year. But here's the catch. 1 to 4 actually use them. That's it. 1 to 4 per year on average will use them. And part of that, here's the issue on the enterprise zones. First of all, it's not suitable for most small firms. But it should remain their choice. I mean, some can use it to their advantage. And one example is we had a company with owner-operators, 1 employee, he's qualified. He had 3 years of property tax abatement for one person operator, but he qualified. It's also unsuitable for seasonal. Seasonal businesses cannot use it because wages go like this. They have to be sustainable wages to meet the qualifications, otherwise it doesn't work. And it's also a chance for businesses employment income. And I think that's one of the issues. Once they get out of that qualification, they lose it. And it's very difficult to reapply and bring it back again. And so they have to meet certain standards. Mantech actually did that, and they were able to requalify, but because they had offset some of their operation and handed over to another company. But since then, they've actually filled that backlog of employment and actually increased it. And their wages have gone up, so they were able to qualify again. But those are some of the issues I think you have to be careful about on enterprise zones, where, you know, just because the city may want it, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to happen, because maybe some of the choices or some of the type of companies or businesses that are expanding in that certain area.
One follow-up, Mr. Chair.
One follow-up, and the members, and I think we are limited to understand it, so just keep that in mind.
I think that's a lot of different short schedule, always.
We can wait. Okay, we are going to discuss more on the enterprise zone. It will be a house for 2143, so we will discuss more. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mayor Lightman.
Tell Mayor Hughes to say hello.
And at this time, I'd like to call the Lane County Economic Standing Committee members, especially the Commissioner Bill Dwyer and also Commissioner Hay Stewart. And especially Commissioner Bill Dwyer, we served together in the Senate for quite a while, also as my personal notes. That we went hunting together some time ago. We went to a rabbit hunting, but we were not able to catch any. Thank you, my good old friend.
You know, so you didn't get shot.
That's what they say.
Thank you. Can you get some Thank you so much, Senator Lynn. Once a senator, always a senator.
Okay.
And the Heinrichs Corporation and the community members for having your meetings here and your community. This is a vibrant community, and certainly we have our challenges as most of the community has, but collectively we're going to be working through it. I happen to chair the Lane County, I'm on the board of the Lane County Commissioners. I represent Springfield and portion of the Eugene. And I also chair the county committee on economic development. To my left is our committee administrator, which is Peter Thurston. He is kind of keeps everything going and gives us direction at times, as your committee assistant does. And to my immediate left is really elected Commissioner Hay Stewart, who represents the rural area in Cottage Grove, Mohawk Valley, Oak Ridge, and really depressed district. So we have some really depressed areas that he has to represent. And all counties, Coburg, Power Plant, all kinds of facility siting councils, and you know what that's like, right? My leader, right, is Chuck Forster, who is Workforce Development Coordinator, who runs the workforce training. He works with these companies to train their employees, and he'll speak for himself at the appropriate time. To my right, to the right of him, is Janice Mackey. Janice is a citizen member of our Economic Development Committee. The committee consists of the assessor, Jamie Manuel, who is the only member who is in president. And I guess he's out crossing taxes. And to allow you to see me, and then we happen to be a researcher. Our economic development committee, we use a lot of interns. The 10,000 we have as many as 4 or 5. We come from the School of Public Policy and currently move on and learn about how government really operates. So I appreciate it. We at the county, we have unique differences. We're unique. We're not like the cities. Our spectrum is much, much larger. Our responsibilities are much, much larger. Some of the cities and some of the people and some of the people, they take credit. 4 or 5 people take credit for the same thing, you know. So it's all our money, and it's all our money. But the reality of it is, the county does a tremendous amount of fostering economic development. The fiber consortium that we're in following the greater standard of economic development outside of what this community does, so we don't have a lot of money to move around. We're limited by video lottery. And the committee was born basically in around 2000 because we needed to decide how to spend the good lot money, because the definition of economic development was left anybody's imagination. And it used to backfill kind of slush money. Three banks, you could find money. The government was running short, and you create economic development. So we decided, hey, this is not the way to run a government. We need some definition of what economic development is, how it's applied, what the performance is on our dollars. So we developed written material as to what it is and written proposals. So you don't have copies of our manual and how we define economic development along with some of the stuff that we do. So it's pretty impressive. Basically road money. We give a lot of direct and indirect assistance to the cities that are really important. We talked about my mayor, Lincoln, he talked about detail that we put into $5 or $6 million behind their parkway, we're investing in the Jasper Road extension so we can develop a community there. We give money to Oak Ridge, we help the street maybe the West Broadway. And they adhere to talking about the housing. And we have specific pots of money. We also have, we compete for money. We got tired of the county of just giving money away and had to go into a black hole of engineering and really never ever get to see any roads built. So we wanted to have the communities compete for the money to show us why they needed the money, what they were going to do with that money, and how it was going to result in a better community. And that's a project competition, and that was working very, very well. We found other entities on here that without our funding wouldn't exist. Metro Partnership, we contributed to the Chamber of Commerce, we considered and lots of other folks who collectively we couldn't exist without each other. So we have a lot of problems, but the county has specific problems with that we have what we consider kind of unfunded mandates that restrict us, and such an impactation. We have to collect all the cities and taxes and all the district taxes. We have to populate them and distribute them. We don't get any money for that. We can't charge any administrative fees. We have law enforcement, judiciary, prosecution, all those other legal things that the cities have on a much smaller scale. So our responsibility is different. In terms of enterprise zones in Springfield, my first bill in the House in 1986 when the economy was in the mix was the enterprise zones and make Springfield an enterprise zone. Because it was important. We were really impressed. We were so poor we couldn't even pay attention. We almost got a care package from India. But it really helped. Got so many on board that took advantage of it, put a lot of our people to work, and it is a very, very useful tool. The other thing I heard Mayor Kitty talk about, Mayor Pearson, Kitty, to me, been serving in the House together, and as Senator Lynn, he's young to me, he called me when he wanted to get phone call me late for dinner. But my friends called me Bill. We talked about programs like vertical housing and all those other things. We all remember, and particularly even with enterprise zones, some of the flaws in the process were county perspective. People give away our money without us having the ability to say no. to the school districts and the community college boards. So when the city decided they wanted to be vertical housing and give all this tax abatement away, they don't just give away their money, they give away our money. So we get Lane County, which is number 35 in 36 counties, with the lowest, next to the lowest tax base in the state. We get 9 cents on the dollar. 9 cents. $1.27 per thousand. We get to do all the things that we have to do in the government. An example, the city of Eugene is about $7.55. Springfield is close to $5. Well, I'm aware, even the Covert Fire District gets more money per thousand than we do in Lane County. And we can't create business. We're not the private sector. We can't compete with Hynix or decide to do something. We're reliant on the citizens, and they're not very generous. So as their pocketbooks shrink, our responsibilities increase and our ability to deliver services diminish, particularly with the increase in herds, rates, health care. It's impossible to provide current service level unless you can find some money somewhere. So we have unique responsibility. Our program is unique program. What I'll do is I'll let Peter Thurston, our community administrator, talk about our program and how we have outputs and outcomes. We don't give it away. You might be able to get to us the first time by promising us something. But if you don't perform, you're not coming back. Peter?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Peter Thurston. I work for Lane County and the community of Online Development. And in the material that we handed out, we're all new pages. We've included, I've included a summary of what we've been working on for the last 3 years to implement what Commissioner Dwyer has described to you. And number one at the top or in the forefront of everyone's mind here is to measure outcomes, measure the results of the contract that we met, that the Board of Commissioners has met for the last 3 years in this program. And what that requires is spending quite a bit of time in the very beginning in our request for proposal process of asking each applicant to define what their product will be. And in some cases, it will be jobs, in some cases, it will be training. And in the early round, the first round that we did 3 years ago, it included also some other broader categories, which have now been eliminated from our RFP, and we focus on job creation and training for family with job roles. Those are the two highest priorities, and those are the only ones that we will receive in the first particular rank. The RPS process follows the material that you have here. There is Lane Manual section, which defines how we distribute the living lottery dollars. It's about a fourth page, and it goes on for 3 pages. In the strategic investment section, which is the last page of that 3-page document, is a description of how we put out competitive requests for proposals, and then how the board ultimately receives a recommendation of this economic development committee and makes those awards. I won't go into detail on that. The second page in the blue material is a list of those projects which have actually been funded in the last 3 years with real lottery funds by the Lane County Board of Commissioners. And they are, as I've said, more and more directed toward job creation and raising the wages of the people who are employed in jobs that have been created. An example on this list is toward the bottom is the molecular probes funding, where the Board of County Commissioners recently approved an award to support a state-supported project to increase the molecular probes, creating new jobs and many other opportunities. Another example in here is the interest in developing local business project you see showing up three times in here is Contact. That's run to the G Area Chamber of Commerce, and you may hear more about that when the chamber comes up to speak later, but three times, that's what Commissioner Dwyer said, if they produce, they can come back, and they have been out there working, and we work with them in this way as a partnership to help not just the Eugene, but the 30 communities in the Contact program, and they even go into the smaller communities around the Eugene, Springfield, and metro area to help promote business development. The focus of the county at this point, as I've said two or three times, is job creation and expanding and increasing the family wage jobs that come from that. The committee is at this time rewriting the RFP for this coming year and for the next year. We're already working on typing those down even tighter to get closer to representing jobs that increase for expanding wage jobs. It's not simple. It's a simple thing to say, but it's not easy to measure how you get your hands around what is supporting a family because it relates to size, dollars, benefits, and all of these variables. But that's the goal, is to continue to press these outcome measurements toward being able to spend the dollars to have the greatest effect in creating family wage and more job opportunities.
All right, and thank you very much for the testimony. Before we go further, Mary, excuse me, Lane Community College president is here. She needs to go fairly soon, so if you allow me, and I will have her just give a courtesy to come up and give a testimony work. Thank you very much. Just you may stay there and then just give her one chair.
Thank you, Chairman.
You need to go be there from 2:30. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee, and thank you for the courtesy, and my apologies to my colleagues from the county. We are in an interview process for a senior administrator, and I have an appointment to meet with a candidate who's only in the state for about another 2 hours, and so I have to get back to campus to meet with the candidate. So thank you again for the courtesy. For the record, I'm Mary Fieldy, president of Wayne Community College here in Eugene, and thank you for coming to Wayne County and for the invitation to address the committee. I'd also like to say thank you to Pynex. We're so pleased to be here today. We are very proud of our partnership with Pynex. We've been with them from the beginning, doing their initial training, and continue that partnership to this day, and appreciate your support of our students and their own employees who access training at Wayne Community College. At Wayne, we do have a comprehensive mission, but I want to just focus for a few minutes on the things that we do at Wayne Community College to help with economic development. We've talked today a little bit about infrastructure and enterprise zones and those kinds of things, and those are very important, but we believe that our role in economic development relates to workforce development. And we really see economic development and workforce development being inextricably linked. We have to have both. We obviously live in a knowledge economy, and the fact is that if you don't learn new things, you're not going to work. It's quite simple. You need to learn if you want to work. And so I just want to very quickly give you three examples of the things that we do at Wayne Community College to support workforce development and thus economic development. We offer three degrees and 1 year certificates in professional technical areas in over 50 different areas, from advanced technology, computer technology, allied health, graphic design, multimedia, and human and social services. And within each of those categories, there are a number of 2 year and 1 year programs. About 30% of our over 12,000 full-time equivalent students participate in those 2 year degrees.
And we feel that through doing this, we participate in providing a quality trained workforce to go directly to work for our local community employers. We're guided in that process by over 600 community volunteers, strong business and industry, who work with us on advising us on the curriculum and what we ought to be doing to provide an employee who's ready to go to work. We also work with over 800 businesses in the community, where we place about 2,000 students each term out in the community working in internships so that they can get hands-on experience. And our employers tell us that that is an ideal way to try out an employee, see if the employee's going to work out in the job, and then often leads to the hiring of that employee. So we feel that our professional technical programs are a very important contribution to economic development. The second area is our contract training. We aim to be the premier provider of workforce training in Lane County. We work with our other partners, our economic development agencies, and the Lane Workforce Partnership to attract new employers, and certainly Hynix was an example of that. And what we do is work with the employer to design and deliver training that will specifically meet their needs. And we have done this for a number of years. One area that we want to focus more on in the future is working with businesses who are already here so that we can retain those businesses and help them be more productive, profitable, and hopefully expand. And we, with our additional resources at the college, have repositioned our entire department so that we can be more aggressive in doing that. Aside from continuing to work with Hynix, right now we're doing English as a second language courses. We have worked with Monaco and Marathon Coach companies, Molecular Probes, now Invitrogen, Levi Strauss, Symantec, Weyerhaeuser, Peace Health, Sherwood Packaging, Cumulus Broadcasting, just to give you a few examples of the companies that we have been working with. The third area is business development and employee training, and Lane has a business development center that works with startup businesses to help them develop the management skills to start up and sustain their business. And we've worked with over 2,500 businesses in Lane County. A majority of those businesses are 25 employees or less, and many have five or fewer employees. And while sometimes it's difficult to compare those with an industry or a company like Hynix, obviously in Oregon we're a small business economy, so this is a very important piece of what we do at community colleges. Lane Community College developed the first micro-enterprise business program, and it provides business development outreach for low-income veterans, women entrepreneurs, and their very, very small businesses. And that is actually assisted by the Trinity Edwards funding, so that's an example of a nice partnership. We also have our business technology initiative, which serves more technology businesses and startups and helps get technology into our more traditional businesses. And we will be working with the University of Oregon to provide specialized business development centers as we move forward with our planned incubator. We think that's a very exciting addition to what we have currently has to offer. We're going to hear more about the business development centers from Bill Carter, who is the executive director of the Oregon Small Business Development Center Network, which Lane hosts on behalf of the state. And we're very glad to be a partner in that, too. Finally, then, it's not only through our services that we stimulate the economy, but also just by virtue of the college being here in the county. We have over 1,000 employees. And an independent economic study reflected that taxpayers see a real return of 18.9% of their annual investment. And perhaps more importantly, students who attend Lane Community College enjoy an attractive 20% annual return on their investment of time and money, and make more money as a result of their education. So that, of course, advances the state and helps limit costs on healthcare, on social services and corrections and those kinds of things. I pass read an article from the Oregon Business Magazine that was in the March edition that said that community colleges offer the best and shortest turnaround for investment to get Oregon's economy working again. And of course, as an educator and as a community college professional, I would certainly support that that comment. We believe that we're a powerful solution to help Oregon's economic recovery. And we hope that as you think about in economic development, like the infrastructure kinds of things, that you will also think about workforce development and education as a very important piece of that puzzle. I'd like to thank you very much for the invitation to be here. We're very pleased to be a partner in making Wayne County a vibrant economic area. Thank you for being here, and especially thanks for the extending the courtesy of allowing me to give my testimony early so that I can get on with other college business. I'd be happy to take any questions if you have.
Thank you very much, Madam President. Any questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And I will appreciate the patience of the interruption and appreciate the meeting
Committee members, thank you. I'm a base dealer and county commissioner, and I represent East Lake, which privileged happens to be a rural area in Lake County. I'd like to also thank you for all your efforts and your commitment to improving the economy and giving us tools that we can use in government to help foster and encourage economic growth in our area. It's an absolutely key and vital agreement, or ingredient to success of our communities and growth. So I thank you for that. I'd also like to address Representative Don as when he asked about how these enterprise zones can improve these areas, depressed areas. You know, I know that in Lake County, no matter where these enterprise zones are, they help our areas that are depressed. In Cottage Grove alone, we see that 2,600 or more people down the street every morning to be able to find jobs or in the immediate area. So wherever these enterprise zones are, they do help the areas that are depressed and folks that need jobs. So I'm supportive of the enterprise zones, and I'm also supportive of this House bill to improve the strategic investment program. So because, you know, in businesses anywhere, where it's taking an incredible investment to get started and to open up, I think that it's important that we foster and encourage private and public relationships that that help businesses succeed and prosper in these communities. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, gentlemen. And thank you, Diane. Sorry, and we need to say if you could summarize it somewhat. I will appreciate it, and we are leaving it behind, and thank you for your cooperation.
I plan to make it very brief, so you know, we'll move right along. I am Chuck Forster. I'm the Executive Director of the Wayne Workforce Partnership. In Eugene, we are a workforce development organization that assists employers to find qualified and provide and retain qualified employees, and also work with individuals to gain knowledge and skills to find new jobs and progress in their careers. So that's in the nutshell what we do. And looking at your question about what are some of the key ingredients to success for economic development and business in Wayne County, obviously because of the nature of my business, I feel that a quality workforce is essential to the success of business in Wayne County. I think certain areas skill where I touched on it very directly. Yeah. And if that's a key ingredient, then our challenge is how do we maintain and grow that quality workforce. And to me, there's a twofold challenge. One is to ensure that the young people who are leaving our high schools have the academic and computer literacy skills to actually succeed in our workforce. And the second part of that challenge is to ensure that current workers have access to training so they can have an audience skill to help their businesses be successful in this very competitive global economy. A skilled workforce begins with investment in youth. Unfortunately, many young people coming out of our schools have inadequate math, reading, and work readiness skills. My organization, Wayne Workforce Partnership, over the past years invested $100,000 to help address that of those young people. We also connect young people to businesses to create internships, which have also proven very effective. Regrettably, in the area of youth, and again, youth is important because they are truly the future of our workforce. There has been quite a reduction in funding available for professional technical training for young people in school. There has been, I think a real innovative response to that need in our county. There's been established and started by Lincoln Community College called the Regional Technical Education Committee, which intends to make available training to the kids from the school district who otherwise wouldn't have the training available for boards of Lincoln Community College or other districts. I think it's a very effective strategy, and hopefully we'll continue to grow. But I want to move on very, very quickly to the current workforce again, because that's that second part of that challenge is the current workforce. And again, the challenge is to provide continuous education and training so that those folks have learned the knowledge and skills again to help their employers succeed. We are able to do that through the Governor's Employer Workforce Training Fund. That was a fund that was established using Federal Workforce Investment Act dollars about a year and a half ago. In Lane County, we received about $600,000 of those funds. Today, we've been contracting with 10 businesses of quite a range of businesses, ranging from contrasted businesses, actually, Jerry Coyote, which is really designed cooperative, PLC, the Unified Approach, Lance Cabinet, with quite a range of employers who actually access those funds. And in addition to those 10 companies, represent 800 individuals who will be receiving training as part of that effort. And I'm happy to say that those companies that are completing their training, that they're seeing productivity improvements, and they're seeing cost reductions, and in some cases, sales have gone up, and jobs have increased. So it's a very, very effective strategy. All the things that we do around youth, the things that we do for the current workforce, however, are on a very, very small scale. There is need for tremendous investment in that area. I've got three quick recommendations, and then I will be back. The first one is to certainly do increase our investment in education, especially in professional technical training. I just think that is extremely critical. Secondly, I ask you to work to identify non-federal revenues that can be included in the government's workforce training funds. As I mentioned earlier, this fund, which has proven to be very, very effective, we are in fact using it as well to support some elected approaches and their expansion, but it's only federal funds. It seems to me there must be other sources of state revenue that could be attached to this opportunity. And finally, just in a general way, I urge you and your colleagues in Salem to make a quality workforce a priority for Oregon. So thank you for letting me give my testimony. Do you have any questions?
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Foster. And any questions from you? Okay, we will move on to the next panel. Would you state your name?
My name is Janice Mackey. I'm an attorney with Langlon Gary Rudnick, and I promise to be very quick.
All right.
Thank you for allowing me to testify. My primary practice is working with small and medium-sized businesses. They're just getting started. My firm and the citizens committee member on the Economic Development Standing Committee, and I'm gratified that we can support our local businesses, especially the small ones, through direct support as well as through the Chamber of Commerce and the Lane County Lane Community College Small Business Development Center Micro Business Program. Thank you.
Yeah, my name is Cindy Ingram. I'm a graduate student at the University of Oregon studying public policy and serving as an intern with the Community and Economic Development. And in the interest of time, I'll pass.
Any further questions from the panel? Yes.
Well, we've kind of concluded what we have to say. We'd be glad to take questions. You know, this is the economy is in flux, and we've got to be able to respond. We've got smart people in the community. Hopefully, we've got smart people in Salem, and collectively, we'll be able to figure it out so the whole community will benefit. And I really appreciate you coming down and saying it and spending your time. It's nice to see your beautiful wife.
Thank you.
And it's nice to see Bobby again. And to see this committee, and I don't get to actually know.
Okay. So, any questions? If not, and prior and a commissioner. And thank you very much for organizing this presentation. And I want to thank you, each one of you, for taking time to present this. And we are your partners. And
well, thank you. I need to be excused because I have another meeting too. And you need to send your amendment with me.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
This state and this region and helps to support the local economy. $60 million in non-resident tuition alone. And those non-residents spend another $120 million in this geographic region that comes from outside the region in order to add to our gross state product. In our expenditures, which were about $432 million in that same year, $165 million of that was directly off campus. That's given to the more than 2,000 small businesses in this area. And in fact, of our total expenditures, 85% of them are in this geographic region, Lane, Minn, Bedford counties. All of those counties benefit from the expenditures that are made by the people who come here. The state gave us a small amount of money for research. We multiplied that about 20-fold. In terms of the external money that we've acquired from the federal government through competitive grants, research, and contracts. In fact, last year, in the last 3 years, we have a 56% increase in federal research grants that are given competitively throughout this nation to the best and the brightest only. That is $90 million also that's brought into this economy from outside the state of Oregon, and it goes to pay for high-wage jobs and has a multiplier effect, as this committee well understands, way beyond the boundaries of the university. In fact, the fact of the matter is, Mr. Chairman, that every faculty member taken on the average brings in $150,000 of external money a year. That is to say, they pay for more than their own salaries in terms of external grants. And that does explain something about the economic impact of a research university. The same can be said of Oregon State University, our colleagues in Corvallis. The same can be said of our colleagues at Oregon Health and Sciences University and at Portland State University. So this research and development is an incredibly important economic engine itself, and that's innovation. That's the second of the issues I wanted to speak to ever so briefly. This week's Business Week has a cover story, Outsourcing Innovation. It said first it's manufacturing, now companies are farming out R&D to cut their costs. They're farming them out to other nations, and the editors tease you by saying, is this a good thing? Ladies and gentlemen, it's a disaster for this nation. If we outsource research and development, the very fountainhead of innovation that has been the signature of the American economy since World War II. And just, if I may ask you to visualize how large that impact is and why it is that the United States of America is the world's single most powerful economy. The President's Council on Economic Advisors in 1995, and I think in years since, it doesn't matter on the party of the President, the Council of Economic Advisors agreed that about 50% of the phenomenal growth of the American economy since World War II is traceable directly to research and development, and the fantastic cycle of innovation that has emerged from this country. And the majority of that has happened in America's research universities. So this very entity is absolutely critical in terms of developing everything from transistorized communication to the internet. It has so much to do with value added in our economy. It would be a disaster to think that we would cede away to other places in the world this economic engine of innovation that is a part and parcel of our own state's economy. I mentioned to you that we're a cycle, that we are institutionally involved in innovation, and perhaps that's not generally known. But last year, we earned nearly $2 million in licensing revenue alone from our patents, from our trademarks, from our software. Those things that independently were developed and discovered by University of Oregon faculty and were turned into commercial products and actually are returning income back to the university for future development of future ideas. In fact, we are one of the top 25 producers of licensing income of all universities in America, not generally known. But we actually produce more on a per capita basis than our colleagues in Corvallis or those on the Oregon Health and Sciences University last year. We had 40 new inventions last year and 36 new inventions, that is to say those that can be copyrighted or patented, the year before that. We have 18 startup companies at the University of Oregon, including three that have started already in fiscal year 04. So this is an active source of innovation. Another magazine I might point to, and unlikely one perhaps, the National Geographic for March, shows a very distinguished person involved in meditation, and there's this funny thing that probably looks funny from your distance, called the neural net, which is measuring the brain waves of the person to see whether or not meditation actually can change the structure of the brain. The answer is that it does. The neural net was invented at the University of Oregon. was spun off into a private company, which is a profit-making company that continues to bring in revenues to the university, and beyond that continues to bring in fundamental discoveries about the very nature of human consciousness and the human mind and how the brain works and how, in very practical ways, this can address issues of learning disability or problems of stroke, the second highest healthcare cost that we face in terms of disability that we have with rehabilitation and recovery. Those things are happening at our state's research universities. They're happening at the University of Oregon. You may have read earlier this week, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that Jim Hutchison, a chemist on the faculty of the University of Oregon, has just received a patent from the United States government for a nanoparticle device that basically hooks gold particles at the atomic level onto the chains of DNA and provides the basis for tiny transistors that might be developed in the next generation of the electronics industry. This is significant enough that the United States government has granted a patent for it. It creates the possibility of the next generation of computers that would basically be the size of the wristwatches that you all are wearing, but would have the present computing power of the desktop computer that we all use. That's not happening in some Silicon Valley factory. That's the kind of discovery that's occurring through our Onami initiative, which we share with Oregon State University, Portland State University, and Pacific Northwest National Lab. So we have a collaborative network of discovery and innovation that will help, I hope, to answer the challenge that the editors and businesses have posed to us about whether innovation stays here or whether innovation goes offshore to the disadvantage of the United States. That's something, Mr. Chairman, to respond to your first question about economic impact. You asked in the second question about the region's strengths and weaknesses and how we approach those. And let me simply identify three. Two are strengths and one is a weakness. The first strength is that our major universities increasingly involve industrial clusters because, as my colleague from Wayne Community College pointed out, this is a knowledge economy in which we're engaged. Molecular probes, an industry which we just referred to by the county commissioners, is in a building actually just behind us over the other side of the hill. It is Oregon's most successful biotechnology industry, and it started right here in Oregon, continues to thrive here in Oregon. We would not be here but for the fact that a research university with a major molecular biology department is immediately in the neighborhood. So these clusters of universities and spin-off companies of high technology and high knowledge industry are incredibly important for our future. That's a great strength. The second great strength is our human capital. Our colleagues from Hynix pointed out how important that was in their decision to site this particular plant in this community. And Oregonians, as we know, are our greatest resource. The United States Census Bureau data that was just released this week pointed out again something that we really know that it needs emphasis. The difference in earning power right now between a person who has a college degree and a person who has only a high school diploma is exactly 2 times. The person who has that college diploma will earn twice as much through a lifetime as the person with a high school degree. That's pretty alarming data from the 2000 census, but it tells us where our next generation of effort needs to be in terms of higher education, getting as many motivated young people through college as possible can. Our industry clusters, our human capital, are two great strengths. Our third, which is a weakness, will not surprise you, I suppose. And that is that the state's disinvestment in higher education over the last decade has been alarming beyond belief. I say that in the context of a person who has visited Korea, Japan, China, Taiwan, and will visit in just a few short months Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam. All of those countries, and I know the university presidents from each of them because they're part of an association that meets annually, are making enormous investments in higher education because they see the future of this knowledge economy emerging and they don't want to be finishing second best to anyone. We can't continue that disinvestment. This legislature is in a position at least to respond to that question, and we're hopeful that the governor's budget at least will be the starting point for a reinvestment in this absolutely critical economic resource of human capital and of research and development. And finally, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, you asked a third question, which is there anything else that this committee might do? And our answer, thankfully, is yes, and we're quite specific. We hope we'll have before you Senate Bill 838,
in due course. That Senate bill establishes the Oregon Innovation Council, again, directly addressing the issue of how most effectively we find inventions that stay home, that are commercialized, that create jobs here, that create spin-off companies here, that create the knowledge economy of the future. Senate Bill 838 consolidates a number of prior efforts into a single bill, creates the Oregon Commercialized Research Fund. And then associated with that, there's an absolutely crucial $7 million appropriation for ONAMI. That's a long acronym, but that stands for Oregon's Nanotechnology Initiative, the collaborative effort, again, with Oregon State University, Portland State, and the Pacific Northwest National Labs. That's the effort with which our chemist, Jim Hutchison, was associated when he developed this new patent that I described to you just a few moments ago. So that's the first of the specific things that may come to this committee's agenda. The second, we hope, will depart from the Senate in due course from Senate Judiciary, that's Senate Bill 220. That would establish an independent right of the state system of higher education to have attorneys who are able to move very quickly on many of these technology transfer issues, and give us authority for our own legal counsel to deal with these specialized areas. That's been a matter of some contention between us and the Department of Justice. Senate Bill 220 would address that issue. Mr. Chairman, I do appreciate the rush of time that you have. I have other thoughts that I might share at greater length, but I'd be pleased to respond to questions. And I really do thank you for hearing this out and for coming to this community to hear about the importance of all of these ventures.
Thank you very much for your very knowledgeable and provoking presentation. If you appreciate the questions from the members of the representative, Dr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bill, you made such a compelling case for investing in education experts. I'm wondering, after your next international trip, what will it take for you to come to the sales meeting and most groups of announcements and a caucus?
I think I had to carefully put partisan allegiances very carefully aside. I'm perfectly willing to waive all appearance fees for the party caucus in English to hear.
I just want to keep it in the Republican. Don't even think of that. Okay, and any questions here? Okay. In your presentation, outsourcing is one of the issues you just mentioned. And at the same time, the global competition is another issue. Can you address those issues? Of course, we want to keep every job we can get in the United States, but in the global competition, sometimes because of the higher cost of labor and close orders, as opposed to the other countries such as China or any others.
Yes, and I don't want to speak too broadly on that, Mr. Chair. That my remarks led me to believe that we can prevent everything from going offshore. That clearly would not be a correct conclusion, because labor does seek its own cost in some markets. We do know that we have been outcompeted in terms of many manufacturing efforts that are offshore really forever, as far as we can tell from present technologies. But what I'm talking about here is outsourcing brain power. I think we need to keep our homegrown brain power cultivated to the highest possible degree. This is the basic source of the knowledge economy, which is what comes out of people's heads. And while we want to take advantage of all the brain power around the world, we need to make sure that we don't export our own, or at least that we don't outsource our very capacity to innovate itself. I do commend, actually, I think the article in this week's Business Week is thoughtful because it tells us the extent to which this is already happening. I think that the signature industries, particularly, are electronics, and therefore fitting that we are in this company today. It is a world market. But one of the things that we've done, and Mr. Chairman, you know this involves activities of the federal government rather than the state, but something in which I hope that you're all as elected officials aware. And that is that the current visa restrictions and the perception that this country is unfriendly to foreign students and foreign academics is very dangerous for us. We saw 2 years ago a 30% decline in applications from foreign countries to be international students, not only at the University of Oregon, but at the nation's major research universities. And if you look down 30 years down the line after some student has come here,
and many of them stay here from other countries. They're winning Nobel Prizes. They're winning the London Prize in physics. They're winning and making major inventions. And they're on the faculties of our research institutions or founders of basic companies having left the academic world. But if they don't come here in the first place because of a perception that our visa procedures or immigration procedures are unfriendly to them, then we're going to lose that world market of importing capital from all the rest of the world, which has been our unquestioned comparative advantage in this world for the last 30 years. And that's very dangerous for us. Happily, our foreign student numbers have stabilized, but we still suffer a disadvantage. We're down about 300 students from where we were before September 11th. And many research universities are way below that in their numbers. We can't continue to create that kind of barrier to the development of an import of foreign intellectual capital here and still maintain the position that I've described to you has been so crucial to our overall economic development since World War II.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time for coming out to testify, and we will deeply appreciate it. This is how we remember the citizens' journey and the Senate Bill 838.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. May I just make one final point? I'm going to submit to you information in case you don't have it as committee members of the University of Oregon developed Index of Economic Indicators for the State of Oregon. This is something that we've started doing in December. It's peer-reviewed and tested, and it will give individual committee members a chance if you bookmark this every month to see what the indices of economic activity are. It's Oregon-specific, and it's done by some of the finest economists in this country. And I think it will be a technical help to all members of the committee. So I'll commend it to you now, and you will receive the written and email information about it.
All right. Thank you, David. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. And we will go to the regional economic development. And at this time, I'd like to call the Dave Townsend, the president of the Union Chamber of Commerce. And also, should I call Jeff Roberts? Can you come at the same time? Former Labor Commissioner, my colleague and friend. Also, the Brian Rooney is here also. Thank you very much. I just want to start out first. All right. Welcome. Please state your name.
Thank you, Chairman and committee members. My name is Dave Hauser. I'm the president of the Engineering Chamber of Commerce. We're a 1,200 member business organization committed to promoting a healthy economy for Eugene. Let me add my thanks to you and the committee for taking the time to come to Eugene today. It's a pleasure to have you here. And thank you to our host at IMEX for the tour and the lunch and the hospitality today. As I suspected, many of the speakers that have preceded me have done an excellent job talking about the economy, Eugene, Springfield, and many of the good things that are going on here. So with your indulgence, I'd like to zero in on just a couple of issues and challenges that we face in building a healthy economy for Eugene. I'd like to just briefly talk about the issues of land supplies and land prices. Like many cities in Oregon, Eugene is facing a critical shortage of commercial industrial land. In 2002, our organization commissioned a study of the current supply of commercial industrial land, and we were taken back by what we found. Back in 2002, we could only identify 1,214 acres of industrial land in all of the city of Eugene. And to help provide context to that number, in the decade from 1990 to 2000, we had absorbed about 1,350 acres of industrial land for industrial and other community purposes. That is in contrast to what our city planners had projected as a use of somewhere between 250 and 475 acres for that period of time. To make matters worse,
most of the industrial land that we have in Eugene is full of constraints. It has environmental issues, access issues. There are only 484 acres of land when we conducted this study that were determined to be free of constraints. Of that, 79 constraint-free acres, most of them, 53%, were less than 3 acres in size. Our commercial land supplies are in even worse state of affairs. And while land use issues are not necessarily the purview of this committee, it's difficult to disconnect Oregon's land use laws from our desire to build a strong, healthy economy and provide jobs for our state residents. So I thought you might appreciate just the magnitude of the challenge we face here in providing an adequate supply of commercial industrial land to meet our economic development goals. And while here, I know you're holding a hearing later, in just a few minutes, I also wanted to offer our chamber's support for expanding the number of enterprise zones in Oregon as proposed by House Bill 3143. Here in Eugene, we know firsthand that enterprise zones are important tools in building a healthy local economy and creating quality jobs for local residents. We operated an enterprise zone here from 1987 to 1997. During that period of time, we helped bring 9 new companies to Eugene, and we helped promote the expansion of 48 companies. We know from past experience that most new jobs created in any economy are created by companies that are already located here. I think the number is 80%. And enterprise zones here in Eugene have played a critical role in helping local companies expand and provide those new job opportunities. We also know that those enterprise zones are enterprise zones, help increase revenues for important public services. Detractors of enterprise zone typically focus on the fact that it defers property taxes for some period of time, overlooking the fact that they really encourage new investment that means new jobs for local residents, income tax, and ultimately property tax following the exemption. It just seems so appropriate to hold this meeting here and at Hynek Semiconductor America to talk about enterprise zones. As Mr. Doran referenced, our enterprise zone played a very important role in bringing Hynek Semiconductor to Eugene. For an enterprise zone benefit of about $49 million, we have an enormous benefit in our community. As referenced earlier, according to an analysis conducted by a group of economic students at the University of Oregon, using the enterprise zone to secure this facility has resulted in a net economic benefit of $270 million in the form of local taxes paid, construction of electrical substation, taxes paid by employees, and more. In fact, as referenced by our mayor, Hynek's today accounts for about 6% of the total property tax of Eugene, and according to this same study, paid about $5.7 million in local taxes in Main County in Eugene. And it's not just large companies that benefit from enterprise zones. Another study of the West Eugene Enterprise Zone, conducted by a group of honor students at the University of Oregon, compared employment growth of firms inside the zone from 1985 to 1996 to a control group outside of the zone. And what they found is that firms grew faster inside the enterprise zone than outside, particularly smaller firms. So we know that enterprise zones are very beneficial to the growth of small companies. As I mentioned earlier, our community allowed our enterprise zone to expire in 1997. Today, we have rediscovered its importance to our local economy, and we will be applying for a zone for our community. The downside is the limited number of zones currently allowed in the state means that the reauthorization of existing zones or the designation of a new zone for Eugene will result in somebody winning and somebody losing. That's unfortunate when responsible economic development is the goal of so many people across this state, urban and rural alike. And so to the extent that House Bill 3143 would create more access to enterprise zones, for those communities who desire this kind of economic development, and you view it as a very good thing, and we hope that you'll support it. Chair Lynn and committee members, thank you again for taking the time to be here today and providing this opportunity to comment. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Houser, thank you very much. In the interest of time, we should have all three presentations and then see if there are questions from our committee members.
Thank you. My name is Reverend Jack Roberts. I'm the Executive Director of the Women of Faith Partnership, which is an organization of private nonprofit formed 10 years ago this year by the cities of Eugene and Springfield, Wayne County, and Eugene and Springfield Chamber of Commerce. My responsibility is economic development in this area. I certainly agree with the comments of Mr. Houser. I want to talk a little bit about some of the other things you've heard reference to, but to put them in context, some of our success stories recently. You know, coming down, you may have noticed as you were approaching Eugene, and certainly it's not, I urge you to look as you're leaving I-5 and going north. Just to the right of Eugene, as you're heading north, actually, the Beltline exit, there's work going on there, and the site looks into the future home of World Caribbean Cruise Lines, a new call center. The building is a $60 million investment, and going to employ 1,000 people over the next 4 years. We created on a regional basis for that. With the West, and we're able to secure that in this area as an addition to our employment base. We've heard mentioned several times of electric roads, which is actually now a subsidiary of the future gym. We've noticed in the community, we noticed this is unique, that you pull down this lane to leave here, it's on the left. There's, you'll see work proceeding there. This is a homegrown company that is now the largest biotech employer in the state of Oregon. They have been sort of a local secret for years, owned by a couple who developed it here, in large part with the assistance and the work of the University of Oregon, and then sold out at a substantial profit to a global life technologies company in Petrogen. And like many communities who were scared to death they were going to leave, instead they invested another $15 million in upgrading the facility, expanding that to add another 100 jobs. Half of those are PhDs and masters. They are a crown jewel in the Nutrigen family, and they want to be here. They want to take advantage of our quality of life. They want to take advantage of our university. They want to take advantage of the fact that they have a lot of brain power to be part of this company that probably wouldn't leave if they left. So all those things help us. We mentioned recently that Williams Bakery, which is part of the U.S. Bakery family, also friends that live up in the Portland area, has relocated, the bus is relocating and expanding here as they're trying to expand in Portland. This is an interesting phenomenon where a few years ago, a few months ago, when the Atkins side was all the rage and we wondered if anyone was ever going to sell bread again. And partly as a result of that, the holding company for Wonder Bread, the largest bread manufacturer in the country, has filed Chapter 11 bankruptcy. But this is a company that's poised to help take advantage of that and to grow and expand. It's an Oregon company. We're trying to help it grow and expand in Portland and here in the Wayne County area. And they've made a commitment to grow and expand. We also have the fastest growing manufacturing industry here, which is the RV industry. And you'll see that, again, you can see that when you came in, you'll see there on your left of your company, you're going north. At Cobra, you have Monaco, which is our largest private employer, so 2,400 people work here. Smaller company, Marathon, but it makes these huge bus conversions that the rock stars and athletes buy. They start about $1 million and go up, and they have a hard time beating the man. If you're going up 99 toward Corvallis, you'd see in Junction City Country Coach, which has about 1,600 employees, another RV manufacturer, top of the line. And the latest statistics we keep watching is RV manufacturing is creeping up on wood products as the number one manufacturing employer in Wayne County. And both of those are healthy industries here, but the RV industry growth has been fantastic. And we're working with those companies now to help them grow and expand. One thing that all those things I just mentioned you have in common is that we have worked with them with the strong assistance and support of the Oregon Economic and Trade Development Department. And I sometimes think that a lot of these UAV workforces, a lot of people still don't understand just how critical that agency is and the partnership that we have at the local region level. There are not only our great technical people,
health officers, now known as visiting health officers throughout the state, who help work in that area. Their support in each of those cases mentioned, right? Economic fundamental reasons why those companies wanted to either come here or stay here. But in each case, I think we would have been hard pressed to get the commitment, the investment, and the growth there without the help of the economic department. So I would urge you, as you're looking at the strategies for the future of the state, that you not lose sight of the importance of that agency. It's easy to take them for granted. It's easy to make them whooping boys and constituents following. They're not getting enough attention if things went wrong. I understand all that. But I want to assure you, as someone who's working out there in the field, their job is critically important and our success. The final thing I want to leave you with is that this state is struggling because during the recession, we primarily lost manufacturing jobs. And as a state, we've been adding back the lower paying jobs in other areas. But in Lane County, over the last year, half the new jobs we created were in manufacturing. And that's because of companies like Hynix. It's because of the stabilization of the rural products industry, and it's especially because of the growth of the RV industry. We are working to help build on that. We think that diversified economic base is important, but especially that the family wage jobs are represented more. And that's what economic development ultimately is about. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian Rooney. I'm a regional labor economist with the Employment Department. And I want to thank you for allowing me to give a brief overview of the Lane County economy. I can keep it brief because a lot of what I was going to say has already been said, but I can put it into context and maybe frame another for you. Prior to the downturn of the early 90s, Lane County was very dependent on lumber and wood products. During the 1990s, we were able to bring some high-tech companies, Symantec and Hynix, are two of the most significant that are still here. And we also had a homegrown recreational vehicle industry that was able to grow during that time period also. The creation of those high-end wage manufacturing jobs, creating money for services and retail, further diversifying the economy. Of course, as I mentioned before, we have the University of Oregon, and we're also a regional center for government, federal, state, and local, so that for a small economy, it's really very rather diverse, and that diversification helped us in the last recession. Statewide, in particular in the Portland area, there was a correction in the high-tech industry. In this area, we have high-tech, but our dependence wasn't so much, and so we weren't hurt as badly when there was a correction in that industry. So the diversification in this area is very good. Moving on down, I'm working from this handout. And moving on down to the handout, I have a list of the largest employers, and that's provided by the Eugene Area Chamber of Commerce. And just a couple of things I'd like to point out. First of all, like any area in the country, some of the largest employers are hospitals and local government, in particular the school districts. In this area, again, we have the University of Oregon and quite a contingent of federal government employees. A lot of that has to do with rural land management and also the Forest Service. If you move to the right, we have a list of the top 10 county manufacturers. And this points to diversity in manufacturing that I was talking about. Three of the companies there are RV manufacturers, Monaco, Country Coach, and Marathon. Then in the middle, we have Hynix, Mantec, PSC Scanning. Those are all high-tech companies. And then we have Weyerhaeuser, Roseboro, Goodyear Wood Products, which I'm sorry to say in the paper, had their first layoff at their company in 26 years. But you're probably still one of the largest employers in the manufacturing sector. And after that, we have McKenzie Forest Products. But it just goes to point out that diversity of manufacturing that we have. Wood products is still important, but we've been able to add some high-tech, and the RV industry has really grown. Turning now to page two. The most recent data, and these are recently adjusted data, shows that we had a recovery from downturn in 2004. 2003 was a bad year for us. Early on in the year, we lost Sandy Disk manufacturing plant. That was around 200 to 350 jobs. Also, the importing of products. That's a small layoff spend. Since then, in 2004, we've had a pretty good rebound. And I've got, under the second bullet there, I have the actual numbers. But I'm just going to go down the list and describe what's been going on with some of the industries. In construction, we've had a real good mix of employment growth in residential, commercial, and public. There's been highway construction, and building permits are up. And there's also quite a bit of commercial development and redevelopment. In manufacturing, most of the growth there has been in RV manufacturing, but stability in the wood products industry has really helped there. Wholesale trade is a secondary industry, which grows and declines in the economy in general. You can see that there's a pretty good gain there, too. Retail trade declined, but that decline is probably statistically insignificant, and we're probably going to be seeing some growth in retail trade here in the near future. Information was down. That's been happening throughout the state and the country. Information includes publishing and broadcasting, and there's been quite a bit of mergers and technological advancement that makes that industry a little less labor intensive. Financial activities continue to grow. Business and professional services had a very strong year in 2004. And that's for temporary firms and call centers. And we actually have a loss of the Stream call center. They used to contract with some Amtrak to do customer service. And that was a loss of almost 400 jobs. But still, that sector grew by 900. So very strong growth in that industry. Health services continues to grow. And then leisure and hospitality also grew in 2004. And that's probably the strongest growth since the 2001 recession and the September 11th terrorist attacks. So, and government was down slightly. So 2004 saw a very broad recovery from the downturn in 2003. A lot of the published near-term expectations we've heard other people talk about, Jack mentioned Royal Caribbean, Million Call Center. There's a lot of construction projects in the works. There's a lot of inertia in construction. So that should be strong for at least several months. Molecular Probes is expanding. And also a couple of our software companies have been expanding. Rapid Meter and Lunar Logic have gotten some contracts. And it's good to see that industry grow also, because that dovetails with the University Board and some of the educated jobs. And finally, as I said before, Rear Wind Products announced a layoff for 57 people. And that's their first layoff in 26-year history. They manufacture furniture, and they blame some of their losses there on competition from China. Finally, on page 3, I provided a table. And I'm not going to go into detail with the data dump that I have there, but I provided that as reference in case questions come up about the relative size of industries and what's happening between 2003 and 2004. With that, that concludes my testimony, and I guess our panel is open for questions.
Okay. Questions to the presenters at this time? Representative Daniel, do you have a question?
No.
Oh, okay.
Frequently looking, so I have a question.
We have some more questions here. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Okay, the last presenter, but not least, is the Small Business Development Center, Neil Ricardo, and Abel Poya.
One more question?
Appreciate your
preservation.
Chairman, I just have a couple of minutes of comments, and working today on Mr. Jim Lindley, the director of the local biz center here at the Lincoln Community College, and we introduced two local small business people that are very easy to work with.
With us is Mary Folser with Stern Sorgan and Dow Oil with Rick Flyers.
Welcome. Chairman Lynn, members of the committee, welcome to James Springfield and Lane County. It's nice to have you down here. For the record, my name is Dick Carter. I'll keep my comments brief, but since I was just in front of your group, your committee last week, I am the state director for the Oregon Network of Small Business Development Centers in Oregon. We are known as Biz Centers. It's our brand. They are hosted by our public colleges in Eugene. The local Biz Center is hosted by Lane County College. Thank you for the opportunity to make some remarks about small business in Lane County and also throughout Oregon. Thank you to our hosts for having us here and for the partnership with small business and the large businesses. It's important to recognize that we're in this community. Mr. Chairman, a few minutes ago or earlier this afternoon, you made a reference to it being April 1st, and I'm wondering if the fact that I'm asked to talk about economics and statistics after 3 p.m. on a Friday afternoon is related to that. Mr. Chairman, across Oregon on the first of every month, like today, there are tens of thousands of small businesses. These owners are handing out their payroll checks to yesterday or today. Over 51% of Oregon's private workforce is employed by a small business, which means that the majority of the paychecks, the payroll checks being deposited today, were signed by a small business owner. There are 330,000 businesses in Oregon. Over 90% of these businesses have less than 20 employees. Oregon is definitely a small business state. In Lane County, there are an estimated 10,000 businesses. The majority of these are small businesses. These small business owners and entrepreneurs are a critical element of our state and daily economies, as are our larger employers. Small businesses are the suppliers, the transporters, and the partners of our larger businesses. In my travels throughout Oregon, one of the great parts of my job is I get to talk to a lot of dreamers. They're the dreamers that live here, the ones that had an idea, a spark of imagination to create their own business. And I get to hear their stories. People like Mary and Bell. Prior to my career in public service, the job that I have now for over 20 years, I, like these Lane County small business owners, signed, sealed, and delivered payroll checks to my employees on the first of every month. I understand from my own experience the challenges that these people face every day. During the startup phase, hiring a first employee, which is a big challenge, a threshold, finding loans and operating capital, growing, meeting or changing customer expectations and needs are the challenges small business people face every day. The 19 business centers throughout Oregon work with over 10,000 small businesses every year, and that's still just a small percentage of the businesses that can probably use the types of services that are available. Everywhere in Oregon, there are small business owners and entrepreneurs, and they're the risk takers, the innovators, and the foundation of our economy, and the engine of economic growth. 2 out of 3 new private sector jobs occur in small businesses. And if I could submit possibly next week, I recently read a research report. There's been a lot of talk about an innovation economy. Small businesses have a very significant role in innovation and knowledge economy, and I'd like to have that information made available to you. So with that, Jim.
Chairman, members of the committee, thanks for being here and having me here. My name is Jim Lindley. I'm the director of the Business Development Center, also of the Employee Training and Workforce and Career Development Departments at LCC here in Eugene. We have an umbrella of services at LCC we provide for economic development. We have the Business Development Center, which Bill is associated with and runs the network here in the state.
forth. And those are for startups and existing small businesses. And normally those are businesses smaller than 200 employees. We have our employee training department, and that's incumbent employee training. And as Mary Spielby mentioned, we're doing some, this is the second language training here for Heinrich right now. And then we have the workforce and career development, and that's really the dislocated workers. So when people are laid off from their jobs or a company's downsizing, we help them transition. And we work with the Workforce Network. We're part of the Workforce Network and work closely with the Lane Workforce Partnership here. So we have a nice story to tell out in the community. We can help a business get started. We train their employees and adapt to downsize. We can help those employees transition, and we can also help invite employees. So it's a nice story when we're out talking with the businesses in the community. But what I want to focus on is the Business Development Center, because I think that's the strongest arm of these three groups. With the budget cuts, I just want to tell you that happened here about 3 years ago. We're running at about 60% of the budget that we had about 3 or 4 years ago. And what that's done is we've had significant staff reduction. And in fact, I was one of them. I was faculty and got laid off and then came back and was hired back as a director. We're working leaner, smarter, and harder. That's probably a good thing. But in all honesty, you can't take any further reductions without a significant drop in services. And we really worked smarter to keep all those services that we had in the past. Our other thing, and then I might add our other funding sources, the SBA and the CDB, we're probably make up 15 to 20% of our funding. The funding there has been flat for a number of years, which with all our cost increases, is almost like a net reduction in our funding. So one suggestion I wanted to make was just no further cuts in college funding. The other thing is we continue to serve the small service and retail businesses, and you've heard Mary talk about that in the bill too, but we also serve the larger and more technology-oriented businesses. And in fact, I'm just going to say this as everybody's taking credit, but Molecular Probes, when the Hoglands were just starting out and was on their kitchen table, they came to the Small Business Development Center and worked with Gina Mays, and she up and built that company from, like I said, from the kitchen table. So. We have to play a role there. We do work with a number of larger companies, and I was just going to name a few: Pacific Europe, and Cottage Grove, Cumulus Media, Computer Systems Western, Eugene, Pacific Alloy Components in Springfield, Creative Composites up in Oak Ridge, organically grown company here in Eugene, McDonald Wholesale. Some of these companies have 150, 180 employees. So we work with some of the other ones. So we'll actually, we're in the midst of a T initiative, which is to get a technology accreditation from the National Association of Small Business Development Centers. So we'll get more skilled at technology transfer, technology advising, and planning, and then also SBIR and STTR funding, which are grants from the federal government. So we could use whatever help we could get on this T initiative, because there are some additional costs here. And then last but not least, we have two clients here we're going to put on the spot from the Business Development Center. I'd first like to introduce Val Boyle, because I'm kind of putting these people on the spot. She was past International Marketing Manager for Burley Design and is now President and CEO over at Flyer, which is an international marketing company for the sports industry. And I'm just going to let Val talk a little bit of maybe how we help her with the Business Development Center.
I first want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to you and let you know how important programs like this are to small businesses. I mean, what I do is I help companies, small businesses in the sporting goods industry who manufacture American products, I help them sell their products overseas. It's a great job, and it's a good thing. But the way that I got this started was with the support of a business networking group, a business group that was provided. Jim Lindley is one of the coordinators of that program. And it was absolutely because of that support. Even though I'm a small business, I've gotten the kind of attention where I feel like what I do matters. Because small businesses, we are the backbone of the economy here in Oregon. Between Lake Community College, the Chamber of Commerce, the Federal Export Assistance Association, I've gotten a lot of assistance, and it's made the difference. It's meant that I could start a business and be successful. So I hope that you'll continue to support these types of programs because it comes back to us. It's an investment. You know, the reason that I came here 6 to 7 years ago mostly one because of the livability in Oregon, but also because of the reputation of the educational system, the K-12 education system, the university education system, the community college education system. And I'm concerned because of the lack of investment, our ability to invest. We don't have that reputation outside of Oregon anymore. So I would implore you to understand that these programs, the return is excellent. It's valuable to small businesses. And again, I want to thank you for showing up because it shows that you're really interested in supporting these types of programs.
Next, I'd like to introduce Marion Colster. She's the owner president of Experience of Oregon. And Marion's been in a couple of programs at the Business Development Center. Her company specializes in bus tours around Oregon and the Northwest. She also has her own charter business, and is used by the Portland Trail Blazers and the U of O sport teams. Mike Harris has been a regular customer of hers, and when I told them that she was in one of my programs, you know how you never get any respect. My folks were like, well, do you think you can help her business? So anyway, but she does have a great business, and so Marion, if you tell us a little bit about your experience with the Business Development Center.
Thank you. I want to thank you for coming to our area today, and thank you for allowing me to be here. I appreciate it very much. And I'm not really fully prepared because I didn't think I would be able to speak to you, but I'll be brief and try to tell you the main points of our business. My husband was in the lumber industry for many years, and he wanted to continue in that because he wanted a low-stress job, and that was just his outlook on life, is that he didn't want to have a lot of stress, and he preferred not to work in a stressful area. But after 30 years, they called a meeting at his work, and 15 minutes later, the entire mill that he worked for was unemployed. He went to the Dislocated Worker Program at LCC, and he was counseled and took some classes, and he found out that he had a lot more on the ball than he knew, which was a happy thing. He decided to build on his knowledge of Oregon, and we bought a little tour bus, and we started taking people around. And sure enough, even the people that lived in Eugene and Springfield were to find out what they had been looking at all this time and not really appreciating. So after we got really started, I thought that I needed more help. I've been doing this paperwork and working in the office. And I went to LCC at many of the different business classes, and I've been in Jim's class now, and the one that's coordinated the small business group, and have benefited greatly from it. I think I've been in classes at LCC now for about 10 years. I would like to, while I have the opportunity, I'd like to thank LCC, and I'd like to underscore what Dave Hauser said about our availability for commercial parking. Right now we have 5 large buses, and in the places they allow parking for those buses, there's just not land available. And before we do park, it's questionable now that we're going to be allowed to continue parking there. They have been here since 1996, so that's our present challenge to overcome. But that's a very real issue in our area, and I thank you for taking time to listen to me.
Questions?
Okay,
Representative
Riley. Thank you. I just wanted to say to Mary, you should have your husband join the legislature. Very low stress.
Wait for him.
Well, maybe we could have had such a good program.
thank you, and sincerely, it's an honor for coming and testifying, and we have learned a lot through this public process and presentation, and God bless you continuing in your work, especially small business development is one of that's the biggest and the important the things we need to do in our state, because we are more, we have more small business in our state than any other state.
I like that. There's just one question before you get up.
What is the most small business facing at this time challenges? Is that the money fund or the workforce or state regulations or training? And give us some idea from the background.
Question directly to Mr. or would you like a small business people to answer the question?
Anyone, yes.
All of the above are probably number one. As you know, the government had a small business council that turned the state and small business people involved in the locations and the protection of industry and citizens. Streamlining regulation is important. The rapidly escalating cost of health insurance is putting more businesses out of business faster than any other component. So those are things I think that you're already addressing. Access to capital is important, but not only having the programs, but making the programs accessible. We heard earlier about enterprise zones, but if small businesses don't use them, I think we should look at why that might be the case. As we have programs that come up that we're trying to make available. Making our workforce programs like they have at Lee Community College, I think, is an extremely important part. 51% of Oregon's workforce work for a business that has 28 people, but yet they generally feel disenfranchised from the workforce programs. I think that's a place that we should call them to the falls level.
All right. Thank you very much. I want to know that the small business people are not small. They are big and they are great. That's all the economy of our state. I want you to know that we appreciate that you are working the small business very much. Thank you very much. All right. With that, we are going to close the public presentations. And at this time, I'd like to open the public hearing. The House Bill 3143 identifies on Appendix 10 of this. Before we go, I'd like to recognize one of my close friends, James Lee. He's from Portland. He's a businessman, a former chairman of the Korean National Korean American Federation. And he's also the community volunteer. Just want to recognize that.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, this is House Bill 3143. We have a sign-up sheet over on the table by Eric. I would like to speak on the bill. What the measure does is to eliminate the limitation on the number of enterprise zones that may be designated by the Oregon Economic Development Department. It eliminates economic hardship requirements for enterprise zones, and it eliminates 10-year limitation on enterprise zone designation that would take effect on 9/1/1999. We have attached the Dash 1 amendment, which we got last time you heard this bill, which was on Wednesday. And it's from Senator Feedstar. Lowers the tax credit threshold by 10% and increases the allowable credit from 25% to 35% for capital asset investments. I keep the emphasize a copy of the amendment.
All right, with that, and I'd like to call. Okay. Jack Roberts, are you still here? Yes, we'd like to call you. And also Mike Schultzman here from the yes, Mike. He's from my district, Gresham area. I always try to treat you good.
Mr. Chairman, you do.
Thank you very much. And let's see. Who is that? I'm going to go first.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, can recognize Jack.
Jack Roberts and the Home Rental Partnership. I actually think the Ashland Amendment that you referred to was it was a mix-up. The Senator started looking at a couple of different bills, and that really doesn't relate to this bill because it's in my building as a tax credit. What was intended to be addressed in that one is the issue that Representative Allen keeps mentioning about the issue of economic distress, because we've gotten a lot of feedback from people that that's an element that people don't want to give up. And so we had some language that left that in there, and it dealt with some of the wording of it. I know that Jack is someone who is representing us on this bill. This meeting Tuesday with representatives of the Oregon cities and the associated Oregon counties to try to address their concerns on that same issue to make sure that gets put aside. So hopefully that issue will be put to rest, and we'll be talking about the other elements that are there to be changed, which we think would make a better measure. So our goal was simply to allow each community that wants to have this to be able to access it. What's happening right now, if Eugene has now decided they would like to get an enterprise zone back, they're applying. But there are no enterprise zones available. There are two that come up for renewal. One is Harrisburg, in Junction City, which includes where Country Coach, when they're already manufacturers, I mentioned, wants to expand and utilize that enterprise zone, so we don't want to lose that. The other is Madras. And Madras has now a city-owned industrial park. They have a mayor who is aggressive on that kind of work. They've not really used their enterprise zone much today, but they want to hang on to it. The problem is that now the Economic Development Department decides, do we take away one of those zones and someone has it and give it to Eugene, or do we turn Eugene away? We don't think that choice should be made. Now, if going to unlimited, it creates a problem, and you simply want to increase the number, we can live with that. In fact, when the enterprise zones were created 20 years ago, there were 30. There now are 49. But my concern with limiting that, when you create this competition, and we're saying to some communities, you're not going to be as favored as some others, we believe, ideally, it should be an economic development tool available to all communities who want and to determine if they need it.
One of the criticisms we have is that the state government give away too much. And some of the already companies located here, they might not be able to get this enterprise tax extension process, but some of the companies might be able to. So they are pressured to clean it together and the comment.
Mr. Chairman, I think part of the question here in looking at enterprise zones is whether it is ultimately a net loss to the local governments or to the state. And because the enterprise zones are limited to manufacturing, distribution, and call centers, which typically pay more in property tax than the burden they place on the local government service delivery, there is, in fact, an additional fiscal an impact or you have a fiscal benefit from those investments, that the local communities, in my view, ought to be able to decide that they're going to temporarily defer collecting that tax to get the investment, knowing that when that time is up, they're going to be collecting that property tax and in turn have the jobs, have the creation. And we're fighting for those traded sector jobs that was a from our address over eloquently talking about outsourcing and losing employment. So I understand there's some criticism that we're giving away too much. I would argue that in the case of enterprise zones is really not the case, but that in any event, it's the local communities who decide whether this tool is necessary or not. Many communities have never asked for one. They're talking about Ashland. Ashland really probably doesn't need one. They have a different kind of job. Phoenix, small communities like that, they do. But it's not necessarily a function of size as to do with what the economy has offered. So I would urge you not to look at this as a loss, but rather as a tool that can be used for a net gain for local communities at their option.
And state not much to lose with this enterprise zone that the local government wants to lose because they cannot collect the property taxes and those others. To me, this enterprise zone is like a more local issue instead of a national issue because they have to sponsor this enterprise zone. Am I correct?
Sure, that's true, although I don't want to ignore the fact that the school portion of the property tax is also deferred, and that burden does fall back on the state. But again, I would argue, as in the case with Hynix, where not only is Hynix paying 6% of Eugene's total property tax, it's paying 6% of the local school property tax in that area, and that is a real benefit. And the price that was paid for that was a deferral of a tax on investment that I think very likely would not have been made here at all if we hadn't had the enterprise zone as one of the tools to help attract that investment here in the first place.
Okay. Let me follow up just one more question. I will get that to Hynix is not on the enterprise zone board at this time.
Actually, they are. Because they had used that this before it expired, they've been able to make some new investments. And we'll continue to be able to do that through 2007.
Okay.
And they have continued to utilize that effectively, and we'd like to enable them to be able to continue to use that in the future. There's only one other company in Eugene that has that. It's at the other end of the extreme. It's a small company, Lance Cabinets, and they've been doing a lot of innovative work. And they're a smaller employer, but they do that. So there's a couple that still benefit from that. But the original investment, after that was made, went on the tax rolls. It's only the new investment that is deferred, and it helps them to continue to make upgrades and keep this plant functioning and effective.
All right. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things in my mind. First, Jack, could you tell me if you believe that there are communities who would want to get a brand job and you have actually applied by this time if there weren't a limited number?
I don't think there are a whole lot out there. Again, last year there was one that came up, Silverton, I believe it was, and they did not renew it because they weren't using it. I think there's only one place that applied for it. At the time, we were not able to get our friends in Eugene to make that application. So I don't want to pretend like there's unlimited demand for it. What's important, though, I think, is that right now they come up once a year, and that we're all making it, we have to wait for one to become available. Last year, we wanted to get one in place here, so the electric probe, the folks next door couldn't utilize that. Because they didn't, we had to go to the government's strategic reserve fund, the county, which you heard reference to that, come up with some other resources to help match that to give them the investments. So as they competed for this expansion here with their other locations, and they did that. So it's not like we either have this or nothing, and they're using other money to do it. So the advantage of having an unlimited amount is that when there's an opportunity to invest itself, a community can come forward, make the application, it's going to be more or less pro forma, meeting the criteria, and not waiting your turn, and be able to utilize that as a tool and not be turned away.
And the other is actually a comment, Mr. Chair, about your comment, which is it's a local issue, but if you remember, we just extended e-commerce zones to all enterprise zones, I believe. And
when they came here, not only were they a good employer at good wages, well, we actually got complaints from some of the other employers to be able to raise their wages to their employees to keep up. Frankly, I didn't have a lot of sympathy for that. I thought that was good news. And one of those who complained incidentally was somebody who was already a good employer. She had to agree to that. So clearly, I think the track record is that they create jobs, they create net new jobs, they increase employment, they do all the things you're supposed to do. Now, does it help more depressed areas versus others? That's harder to demonstrate. There are some examples, and we talked earlier about your case where you were competing against Salem and in your community, the Dallas, for Google and there, where Salem chose not to have an enterprise zone, that may have made a difference in that community. By and large, most of the times when we deal with it, Heinixon, again, another example, we were competing against Colorado Springs, to get them here. And with Royal Caribbean Cruise Line, we were competing against Spokane. So that's more of a kind of competition. But does it really do what we want it to do? Help us attract those valuable traded sector jobs and manufacturing jobs that are such a premium today? And does it help increase employment and income? Absolutely, it does.
How many could the companies apply for the price zone now? They could get because the number is 49.
Chairman, right now, as far as I know, Eugene may be the only community in the state that doesn't have one that wants one. That doesn't mean that we could have one new one if we got it. That by the end of the year, some other community wouldn't have that opportunity. Magic's a good example of it. It really doesn't use it very much. There was some question whether they wanted to continue. Now that they're in there, now they have it sitting on the electric park, they're excited, they want to do it. I think they should keep their enterprise zone. I think it's important to them. Harrisburg had one that was not heavily expanded in Jefferson City. It's extremely important. They never had one before. So the country coach wanted to expand. So that's the part of your question I can't answer is what communities are there going to be 6 months, 9 months, a year from now that would like to have one that can't because we're just with this incremental approach of slightly increasing the time we have it. If we're going to be competitive in an increasingly global economy, we need to be able to act quickly. We need to be able to get those tools available. That's why I like the idea of not having a cap, but letting people get it and move it.
My concern is currently, as you mentioned, we have only one current offline of the loan is not available. And the future might be coming more. But it's opening up a limited number. I have some concerns on that. And instead of opening up a limited, maybe we can get up maybe next 2 years. Open up another 10, and then when we come back next to this stage, we can find out how many they are going to be. And also, one of the concerns by that is a critical concern how we might be able to pass it in the Republican majority. But when it goes to the Senate, the Senate might say it's not the best for the state. And so, a limited number might not work. So, I'm trying to. Must be a good number, critically from the business point of view. So, and if you or someone else has confidence in the possibility of the other chamber, we are both to pass it, how we need to pass it on these things. But as long as we don't have a strong support in the Senate, chances are he's not going to go. So, I want to make sure that the business pass in the Senate will pass in the House and also in the Senate, and also make sure government does the deal for this year. So we have to go back to state.
Mr. Chairman, I think what you're saying, and we share your concern that we may have just some numerical increase, but we'll be fine with that. I do think it's important to have the discussion and the consideration. Depending on what direction this goes, if we know what the right number is coming out of
Chairman, I think Mr. Roberts captured the issues and credits on the property tax.
And so the result is our tax bucket is constant size, but we keep poking more holes in it. And then there's less water in the bucket to distribute to higher ed, or to K-12, or to health, or to public safety. And these things, there's no easy answers. There's no necessarily right answers, but it just struck me as you were speaking how, we're wrestling with both sides of the puzzle at the same time and trying to make it through this.
My point of view on that, and I've been involved in watching local EG politics debate this issue as well, which is quite educational. And it's such a valid question. I believe in my heart of hearts, from what I've seen in the business community, that the enterprise zone is a net benefit to our communities. It is not a cost. Because Hynix most likely would not have been here, and our coppers would be 6% less today if they were not here. And that's a troubling thought to me, that you think, well, maybe we would have lost this debate earlier and they wouldn't have been here at all. I also believe that the small businesses that continue to invest, true, we will defer those property taxes for a 3 to 5 year period, but if they weren't going to add on to that property or add some equipment, we're not going to get that tax anyway. So politically, I think from a leadership standpoint, we have to do an excellent job of making sure the citizenry understand how an enterprise zone works. And I don't say that disrespectfully. I think it's a challenge because I've witnessed it and been part of it here in our local community. How do I convince my neighbor that this truly is a good thing and that we're not going to be hurt by it? But I do believe it is the right thing and that our communities benefit by having more traded sector jobs in our community, which ultimately does help income taxes as well as property taxes. So I do believe this is one of those things we should fight hard for because it will help jobs stay in Oregon in the long run. And I believe that it is one of our ultimate goals.
The city is involved, and then once the agreement is city that comes to the state through the Oregon Economic Development Commission, and that agreement is certified. Intel is currently operating under an agreement that was reached in 1999 for that allowed them a property tax abatement for a period of 15 years through 2014. They are eating through their expenditures at a faster rate than they expected and have indicated to the county they want to open another negotiation if they've done to reach an agreement to allow $25 billion in investment between the period of 2010 and 2025. LSI is operating under a SIP agreement. Microchip, which assumed or purchased the property that was left vacant by Fujitsu in Russia, is operating under a revised SIP agreement. And so it is a law that has been well used by heavily capital intensive companies since its inception.
So three companies have been utilized.
It's heavily utilized by those capital intensive companies, and there's every indication they would like to see it remain on the books.
Representative Gallen,
yes, Mike, do you have any notion for what kind of investment we would get if we lowered the bar, and what kind of investment that fund could bring to the regional projection available?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gallen, we haven't seen an estimate of that yet. Our staff is working on that, but we haven't, don't have the numbers back. If passed as prologue, the $20 billion in investment that I was referring to were actual expenditures that do not include the economic activity, the output that is generated annually. In Intel's case, I know that that is approximately $8 billion a year in economic activity, and that is in expenditures for construction, to vendors, for ongoing operations, for payroll, for taxes paid, for community service and other fees that are paid, local taxes across the board. So it's you can extrapolate from that that if there was a company that came to Oregon and had a $50 million or higher investment, that it would have an order of magnitude result from that. I think it is probably one of the most successful economic development statutes that Oregon could have passed to position itself for the high-tech investment, certainly. It is not really high-tech, however. Any major capital investment that is contemplated could theoretically use it. What we found at Intel was that when you pencil out the fees that have to be paid over the life of the agreement, the investment needs to be somewhere in the order of $500 million or greater to really use the law. So if you lower the threshold and make that abatement available to smaller investments, I think you would see similar but scaled down economic activity by those investments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you give us any indication of the history of how the original $100 million threshold was set?
Chair Lim, Representative Broome, I don't have the legislative history on that, but looking at talking to people that were there, so that seemed like a large number at the time, and that's really what was kind of guiding them. And there were a number of other investments that were being contemplated where the company would say, if our tax burden is greater than X, say $100 million on a $2 billion investment, then it's not economical for us to invest here, we'll go somewhere else. And I think that's sort of what led to that number.
Vice Chair, okay?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. So I just had a question about the mechanics of the proposal. If you have a company that's still investing at $100 million, $500 million, would it then be paying the same taxes it pays now as on $100 million, or would its taxes be cutting half down to $50 million?
No,
Well, in Intel's case, under the SIP 99 agreement, we were paying $80 million a year in property taxes. So it was, and that was full burden for the most part.
As I see the SIP program, and the county can negotiate up to 75% of the property tax, as I understand.
The way the law is currently structured, the company
has to hold up $100 million.
The company is required to pay up to a $2 million community service fee. It's actually said in the statutory one that says 25% of the abated tax savings for up to a ceiling of $2 million. Also in the statute are provisions that allow the local governments to negotiate other additional fees as appropriate. And usually in the past what that has meant are payments to schools, investments in workforce development, infrastructure development for roads or sewer or power or water, other direct payments to the local governments just for the sake of it. And so that 25% number is there, and then there's a negotiated amount. Ultimately, the negotiated amount is, it really does get down to whether the company says, it doesn't make sense for us to pay much more than that, or we will, sure. And so that's a negotiated item.
Okay.
Vice
Chair, update?
Of the bill, it talks about the first source hiring agreement with a publicly funded job training provider. Is it possible to provide some information on what exactly that means? Do we have any kind of data on that that shows that business or anyone else has used this? That what
kind of practices have been
under this program?
Chair, I'm not concerned about that. Off the top of my head, the three companies that I'm most familiar with, which are Intel, LSI, and Microchip, each had first source hiring agreements, and in every case, they rocketed past what was required of them. It becomes more difficult when you talk about job retention, however, because then it becomes an exercise in sort of, I don't want to demean the purpose of the language, but you really are putting a lot of administrative energy into just tracking headcount and tracking things that aren't very well defined. In the end, the broader language referring to first source preference is desirable. If you try to negotiate or statutorily require certain numbers of jobs for certain categories, that becomes problematic. And that was what happened to Intel in its 1994 agreements for longer acres of the Aloha facility. And there was a lot of technical language in there, very specifically directed toward the number of engineers and administrative assistants and the fact technicians. Ultimately, in the 1999 agreement, we were able to move away from that specificity and agree generally to make strong and good faith demonstrable effort in first source hiring. I think in Intel's case, its experience in that first decade of SIP, well over half of its employees are locally hired. The nature of their work, however, is, as you can imagine, is extremely technical, and they do actually bring folks in from other parts of the world. But for the most part, we do our best to hire locally, or they did. Brand loyalty runs strong.
Thank you. Representative Devon.
Thank you very much, Chairman. Mike, can you tell us, I heard something else, I know a little bit about a company exercising their options under this bill, and they negotiated a deal with the local community and some money exchanges hands. Is that considered as payment in lieu of taxes? Or is that booked somewhere away by the local community, do you know?
Chair Webb, Representative Dahl, no, it's not considered payments of low taxes because the taxes are paid in a fully burdened way up to the ceiling set by the statute about where as far as the simple fees that are required by the statute or additional fees that are negotiated in the agreement.
Thank you. Do you know at this time any other company applying for SIP program?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware of any other company except Big Dell that's actively looking for an SIP agreement at this point.
Okay. And do you have seen any issues to our state that the SIP program has been good in the past, but only maybe if the data companies have invested more than $1 billion, otherwise it's not that much anything. So this, this bill, $23.49, we are lowering the bar from $100 million to $50 million. And then a rural area from $25 million to $12.5 million. Do you think it makes sense, even though the company might not be a mega company, some medium-sized company might be take advantage of this program if this bill passes?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I do. I think that the advantage of lowering the bar, frankly, is that so long as you don't use it where you go big on the large capital investments and leave that underlying statute alone so that it doesn't interrupt or interfere with either agreements that are in place or those which a company that's looking 10, 15 years down the road might reasonably expect to still have that incentive there, I would strongly encourage that you leave that alone. As far as lowering the bar, the advantage to that is that you begin to move geospatially around the state, and you also begin to open it up to other industry sectors that are also capital intensive at a level that is scaled to their industry. High tech, you are familiar with the numbers that are expended there. You've seen some of that here today at Hynix. But pulp and paper, utility industries, other emerging industries that we're not currently familiar with might benefit from this.
Any other questions? All right. And it has been a great meeting, but before I let you go, that the, I want to talk to the county association of Oregon counties and cities. Make sure they understand this between people and not. They are controlled because it's affecting them.
Right.
So I would appreciate your negotiating with them. And I hope you stay. Okay, so this is like the first one. This one is okay, Scott. Okay, is there any other person like to testify on this bill, either House Bill 2143 or 2349? And since no one at this point, and then I just want to thank you for your patience up to this point. And this has been a very good meeting. As a matter of fact, that we are reaching out to the community. Instead of staying in the Capitol Building and come over here, we are going out to the community. One of the reasons we want to get out there sometime also. And staying in the building all day, many months is not the best for us. So, we had the first public field public meeting in the Dogs on the east side. Now we are having one in the south. And hopefully we might be able to have one in the west side. And so we'll continue to reach out. We want to know our elected state representatives are at work. They're working hard to create more jobs and economic prosperity. And any small things we can do, we are here to serve you. So please let us know. I want to thank you, Mike, for waiting on this moment. And with that, if you have some more business, our meeting is adjourned. I want to thank you again for the Hynix and the president and the members. Thank you, and God bless you.